by Alan Davis, Sarah Pascoe, John Bishop, Maria Lena, Ed Byrne, and Pam Ayres.
The new series of The Infinite Monkey Kate on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
When does it start, Robin?
Starts next Thursday morning at 11.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Friday the 8th of November. This is Today with Michelle Hussain and Nick Robinson.
The headlines this morning. Donald Trump has picked a woman, Susie Wiles, to be his White House chief of staff in the first appointment of his new administration. A new report says barriers to the use of NHS data are letting patients and families down.
Also in this today's programme, as Vladimir Putin praises Donald Trump and says we're ready for talks, we speak to the former chief of MI6, Sir Alex Younger, on how Europe should respond to what Trump might do next. And the former Fox News host, Megyn Kelly, who last week appeared on stage at a Trump election rally, tells us what she's hearing about who'll be brought in next to Trump's top team.
They're looking for people who are both competent and loyal to Trump. I think they think the first time around they found a lot of competent people who couldn't stand Trump and would betray him at the first turn. And then they found some people who loved Trump but were incompetent. And they're looking to fix both of those problems.
And?
Paddington, there's a letter from Peru.
Dear Paddington, your Aunt Lucy.
She's gone and we have no idea where she is.
And yes, Paddington is back. We'll speak to the writers of the new film about his latest adventure. All after the BBC News, read this morning by Jane Steele.
President-elect Donald Trump has made his first key White House appointment, naming Susie Wiles, one of his two campaign managers, as his new chief of staff. It's the first time in US history that a woman has taken that role. Traditionally, the chief of staff oversees the daily operations of the White House and advises the president on policy issues. Our North America correspondent Neda Taufik reports from Florida.
When Donald Trump delivered his victory speech on election night, one of the people he turned to on stage and credited for his win was Susie Wiles. The 67-year-old longtime political strategist, he said, liked to stay in the background. Now he's elevated her to one of the top jobs in the White House, where she will make history as the first woman to hold the title. In a statement, Mr. Trump described her as tough, smart, innovative, and universally admired and respected. In his first term, the former president went through four chiefs of staff who advised him on policy and day-to-day operations. This time around, he's looking to appoint loyalists to carry out his agenda.
In an interview with NBC News, Donald Trump said one of his first priorities when he takes office is to make the border strong and powerful. He said people must come in legally and he had no choice but to carry out a mass deportation of illegal immigrants to secure the country. In his first interview since Donald Trump won the American presidential election, the Foreign Secretary David Lammy has told the BBC that criticisms he had made of Mr. Trump in the past were old news and that he had felt in his bones that the president-elect would win for some months. Mr. Lammy was speaking to our political editor Chris Mason, who reminded him of some of the comments he'd made.
So, April 2019, you said, "Deluded, dishonest, xenophobic, narcissistic, Donald Trump is no friend of Britain." Have you changed your mind, or is that still your view?
This is old news. Here, Chris, I'm sitting here as Foreign Secretary. I've had a meal with Donald Trump. I've met Donald Trump.
Did you talk about this stuff? Did you apologise? Did he bring it up?
Not even vaguely.
You can hear the full newscast interview with David Lammy on BBC Sounds. A report is calling for better access to vast amounts of NHS data that can be used to improve patient care and help research into conditions such as dementia, cancer and heart disease. The review says the NHS holds medical details for tens of millions of people going back decades, but access to them can take many months or even years. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
The independent review led by Professor Cathy Sudlow concluded that the potential benefits from the large amount of health data in the UK were not being maximised. Research about common health conditions, she said, was too often prevented or delayed because systems for accessing the available information were too complex and patients were being let down. Professor Sir Chris Whitty, England's chief medical officer, said that the report should help health leaders and researchers use data more effectively for patients while maintaining confidentiality.
An Azerbaijani official overseeing this year's UN conference on tackling climate change has been filmed offering to arrange meetings to discuss potential oil and gas deals. Elnur Sultanov was recorded secretly by a human rights activist ahead of the COP29 meeting, which starts in Baku on Monday. Our climate editor, Justin Rowlett, has seen the footage.
We have a lot of gas fields that are to be developed, the COP29 chief executive Elnur Sultanov tells the potential investor in the video. He offers to set up a meeting with the Azerbaijani state oil and gas company, SOCAR. The man is actually a representative of the human rights organization Global Witness. Attempting to do business deals as part of the COP process appears to be a serious breach of the standards of conduct expected of a COP official. Neither the Azerbaijani COP29 team or SOCAR responded to our request for comment.
Israel says it is sending two military aircraft to the Netherlands to bring home supporters of the football club Maccabi Tel Aviv, who were attacked after a match against Ajax Amsterdam last night. The Israeli government says the Maccabi supporters were assaulted in a very violent incident. There's been no comment from the Dutch authorities, but local reports in the city say numerous fights occurred. Social media pictures also show people tearing down Palestinian flags. The authorities in Argentina say three people have been charged in connection with the death of the One Direction star Liam Payne. The offences include supplying drugs. The singer died last month after falling from the third-floor balcony of a hotel in Buenos Aires. The family of a nurse who died 2 months ago after taking weight loss injections is calling for greater awareness of the possible side effects of the drug. Susan McGowan from North Lanarkshire was 58 and suffered multiple organ failure 2 weeks after she started taking Mounjaro, bought legally on an online pharmacy. The manufacturer Lilly said patient safety was its top priority and Mounjaro was approved based on extensive assessment of its benefits and risks. The regulator, the MHRA, said new medicines were monitored more extensively for safety issues. The Prince of Wales has described the past year as the hardest year of his life. Speaking to reporters at the end of his visit to South Africa, Prince William talked about how he's coped after his wife and his father were diagnosed with cancer. The heir to the throne said he was proud of both Princess Catherine and the King. Researchers at the University of Toronto have been studying the way vampire bats use the blood they eat for energy. The scientists said their results showed how metabolism can be shaped by a specialised diet. Ken Welch, who's an associate professor of zoology, led the study. He says the information was gathered by getting the bats to run on a treadmill.
There are these tiny little treadmills that are made for things like rats that you can run them on, and you can measure their metabolism by measuring the rate at which they're breathing in oxygen and breathing out CO2. And we gave it a shot. And you can see the videos associated with the article. They are little champion runners galloping along.
Ken Welch speaking that.
Bats on a treadmill.
Thank you for that, Jane. The time is now 7 minutes past six. Elizabeth Rizzini has this morning's forecast. Morning, Elizabeth.
Hello, good morning. Thanks, Michelle. Well, the gloom is set to continue. No big changes weather-wise until we get to Sunday, I'm afraid. And we've been crunching some of the numbers. Odium in southern England has only seen 18 minutes of sunshine since the 28th of October. So it's another very cloudy, gloomy picture again today. Very similar to how it was yesterday for most of us. It's now feeling a little chillier too, but we are starting off the day again on a mild note for this time of year. Most of our temperatures in high single figures, low double figures. It's a little cooler where we've seen some breaks in the cloud through the night across northern areas of Scotland. And again, this is where we're going to see the best of the day's sunshine. So there's some early mist around, some fog patches and some outbreaks of drizzle we've been seeing in recent days. Of course, the drizzle, especially for western coast. The low cloud is expected to last throughout the day. Again, it's not looking quite as windy as it was yesterday, but still a noticeable easterly wind blowing towards the southern half of the UK in particular. A few breaks in the clouds, so some pockets of sunshine, and the best of this again will tend to be across northern Scotland and to the northwest of high ground, so perhaps across parts of Cumbria, Lancashire and northwest Wales too. Temperature wise, we'll be up to between 12 and 15 degrees Celsius for Scotland and Northern Ireland, maybe 16 degrees possible in Scotland, but not quite as warm for some as it was yesterday. And for England and Wales, it's going to be feeling chillier underneath all of that low cloud, just 9 to 12 degrees Celsius. We'll do the same thing all again tomorrow.
Thank you very much indeed, Elizabeth. It's 9 minutes past six. Let's take our first look at the morning papers, the news websites too. The Times reports that Donald Trump wants to make a quick start on tariffs and tax cuts, with advisers drawing up plans for his first 100 days back in office. The paper says his goal of reordering the global economic order already has America's trading partners across Europe and Asia frantically drawing up contingency plans on how to respond.
The New York Times says Republicans on Capitol Hill are grappling with how far they can take Mr. Trump's tax cuts. It says advisers to the president-elect are already looking at ways to scale back what it calls some of his more expensive ideas.
The Guardian leads on Joe Biden's first speech at the White House since Donald Trump's victory and his pledge of a peaceful transition. It says the outgoing president sought to defend his legacy. According to the paper, he's facing growing resentment from Democratic Party supporters over his role in Mr. Trump's victory as the scale of defeat sinks in.
The Financial Times also points to what it calls the blame game over Kamala Harris's heavy defeat. A former Democratic campaigner tells the FT that recriminations are raging in the party, some blaming Joe Biden and others Ms. Harris.
The Eye carries a warning from security sources that Donald Trump could threaten to hold back intelligence from the UK as a bargaining chip. The paper says three agents have told it that the president-elect could select yes men willing to curtail intelligence sharing as a lever to push the UK on key policy issues such as the Russia-Ukraine war.
The Independent reports that Sir Keir Starmer is facing increasing pressure to prioritise a new post-Brexit defence pact with the European Union because of concerns Donald Trump may also dilute support for NATO and focus US military objectives elsewhere. The Prime Minister is attending a European Security Summit in Budapest, the first time international leaders have gathered since Mr. Trump's victory.
The Telegraph leads with the headline, Reeves is driving up prices, warns bank, a reference to a Bank of England warning that last week's budget could add to inflation next year. The paper says Rachel Reeves's tax and spend budget is piling pressure on families and reports that lenders have been raising mortgage costs despite the bank's interest rate cut to 4.75%.
Prince William's stark words about a brutal past year feature on most of the front pages. The Daily Mail says the emotional prince spoke candidly at the end of his visit to South Africa about his wife and his father's cancer diagnoses. Hardest year of my life, reads the Sun's headline. The Times calls it William's own annus horribilis, echoing the late Queen's summation of her year at the end of 1992.
And the Mail says there's a perfect, not Latin phrase, but German word for the kind of gloomy weather much of Britain has been experiencing in recent weeks. The paper explains that a dominant high pressure, which leads to warm and sunny days in the summer, often brings anticyclonic gloom at this time of year, otherwise known as, wait for it, Dunkel Floater, which roughly translates as dark doldrums. Did I get anywhere close to pronouncing that properly, do you think?
I'm not the best judge of German pronunciation.
Dunkel Floater. Do message us if I've got that horribly wrong.
It does sound very
gloomy.
Well, yes, but kind of sort of wonderfully resonant at the same time.
Yeah.
Could be useful. I might, yes.
Yeah, store it up.
I might deploy it.
Store it up. It's now 12 minutes past six. Now we know who will run America for the next few years, it becomes even more important to know who will attempt to run Donald Trump and his White House. Our correspondent, Samira Hussain, has been telling me about the woman he's chosen to be his chief of staff, Susan Wiles.
This is a very big appointment because this person is going to be the closest to the president, you know, constantly with him for meetings and, you know, will be with him in the Oval Office. So it is a very big appointment. And the president-elect, Donald Trump, has selected his longtime campaign manager, who's been with him for the last several years, to be his chief of staff. Now, this is the first time a woman is being appointed to this position. And in this particular case, she's not only very well known to, you know, the Trump inner circle, but she's also well known to the family. And remember that Mr. Trump is probably going to appoint someone from within his family. They're going to have a much bigger role in his administration going forward. And he's definitely going to be appointing a lot of loyalists. So with all of that in mind, it doesn't come as too big of a surprise that you have someone like Susie Wiles, who's going to be his chief of staff.
Does it feel in the city you're in Washington, D.C., that power is already draining away from the White House towards Mar-a-Lago in Florida, even though Donald Trump will not actually be president for many weeks?
Well, that's certainly where all the focus is. You know, you see these pictures of the outside of Mar-a-Lago, which is where President-elect Trump is holding up with his members of his staff and just trying to put together his cabinet or his team. So this is really just the first appointment that we've seen. But really, the subsequent appointments are really going to take shape in the next several weeks. And then you're going to have a clear idea of just the kinds of things that perhaps this new administration is going to be putting forth. You know, the other real interesting thing about Washington, D.C. is as quickly as these elections happen, so too are all the changes within the city to actually hold that inauguration. It's a massive ordeal. And so already all over in parts of the city, you're seeing that there are risers going up, all kinds of construction. So while you're seeing this physical changes that are happening within the nation's capital, you also see that actually the political machinations are very much happening in Florida.
Samira Hussain in Washington, D.C. Thank you.
6:15 is the time. The next COP international climate talks begin in Azerbaijan on Monday. The BBC has had access to a recording involving the top climate official from the host country and what are described as opportunities in oil and gas. Justin Rowlatt is our climate editor. What's the video show, Justin?
Well, the video shows the COP29 chief executive, a guy called Elner Sultanov, and he appears to be discussing possible oil and gas deals. He talks about all the gas fields Azerbaijan has which need to be developed, and he offers to set up a meeting with the Azerbaijani state oil and gas company, a company called SOCAR. Now, Mr. Sultanov thinks he's talking to the head of a Hong Kong company that wants to sponsor the COP29 conference and also to make oil and gas investments in Azerbaijan. In fact, the man is actually a representative of the environmental organization Global Witness. Now, attempting to do business deals as part of the COP process appears to be a serious breach of the standards of conduct expected of a COP official. A former head of the UN body responsible for the climate conference told me Mr. Sultanov's actions were completely unacceptable, and she said it was a betrayal of the COP process. Neither the Azerbaijani COP29 team or SOCAR responded to our request for comment. The UN didn't comment directly, but stressed it required all officials to remain impartial.
And of course, it is just a few days before this meeting kicks off in Azerbaijan, and Biden administration officials will be there. How binding is anything they sign up to on the incoming Trump administration? Will any commitments last for a certain length of time and therefore through part of a Trump presidency or the Trump presidency, as we now know?
They won't be binding. They'll be binding only until the 20th of January when the Trump administration comes in. And we know that Donald Trump's been very sceptical about climate actions. He's called Biden's climate policies the new green scam. So as you say, there will be US representatives in Baku, but nothing they agree. He won't feel bound by anything they agree. One observer told a colleague of mine that the US won't just be a lame duck, it'll be a dead duck. And remember, this conference is all about finance. They're calling it the money COP. It's about raising the cash needed to help fund the green transition in the developing world. If the US doesn't chip in, it's going to make it far less likely that other countries will either.
Justin, thank you.
6:17. Tariffs. That's what we know that President Trump is in favour of. In fact, he's declared his love for them. So how might they affect business here in the UK? Fliss can tell us. She's here with that and the rest of today's business news. Morning, Fliss.
Morning. Yes, I'll tell you what. Shall we hear exactly what Donald Trump has said about tariffs in quite effusive terms?
The word tariff, properly used, is a beautiful word. One of the most beautiful words I've ever heard. It's music to my ears.
There you go. He said he might impose tariffs of 60% on Chinese goods and 10% or more on goods from other countries. Other countries, of course, including countries like the UK. Let's talk to Dr. Arnab Basu, who's chief executive of the radiation detection specialist Cromec, which is listed in London and has customers in the US. Good morning.
Good morning.
What would new tariffs then mean for UK manufacturers like you?
Look, tariffs are never a good thing because it just increases cost and somebody has to pay for that increase, whether the company, the exporter, absorbs that within the margin or in most cases, it's passed on to the customer. And that makes it the goods less competitive in that particular market. So it is a cost increase. So we are looking, you know, how it's implemented. Of course, the election rhetoric, how that gets converted. But ultimately, you know, these are instruments which are reciprocal instruments used in negotiations. So I would urge the government to really work very closely with the U.S. such that the U.S. exporters are less affected by the tariffs. So we can negotiate that these tariffs doesn't come in. But the ultimate solution really is a free trade agreement where we can do business with the USA without having any effect of these tariffs. So
do you see this talk of tariffs on UK goods then as being a starting point for bargaining rather than the actual plan for the new Trump presidency?
Look, it's very difficult to say what in reality is going to be implemented, but tariffs are going to be a difficult proposition for UK exporters if they indeed come in. Now, UK is has got a net trade sort of surplus with America, which means we export more to America than we import American goods. So not having tariffs on either US imported goods or, of course, not having tariffs on UK exports benefits not only companies like us, but UK as a whole.
Now, you're an interesting company because you actually have manufacturing sites in the US, so you would potentially benefit if Trump made tax cuts.
Indeed, look, when we are a company where we export end user products into America, but we also make some products in the UK as class of semiconductor and then send it over to our US factory to finish those products. Now, so tariffs will increase the price of our cost of goods in what we manufacture. But we are also a company which is energy intensive. We consume energy. So for when you look at the cost of energy, when you look at the proposed cuts in corporation tax, and even without those cuts, and indeed the new cost that has just come in the UK on national insurance and labor laws, when you're taking investment decisions, US is making a very compelling case for investment and expansion.
So briefly then, are you considering that if you were to expand further, you would move more operations into the US?
I think the energy cost alone and all the additional costs, even without tariffs, makes the US a much more attractive place for investment, yes.
Because when he's not saying that the word tariff is beautiful, he's saying drill, baby, drill.
Indeed. Look, I mean, UK and US have got, you know, we'll have two different energy philosophy. We are trying to build our energy based on green energy, which comes at a cost in the short term, whereas America, going towards natural resources, which are a much more matured source of energy. And of course, the cost differential will make a massive difference to industry where they produce. So I think it will be interesting to see how that develops.
Dr. Arnab Basu, Chief Executive of Cromec, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning.
Now, thank you very much.
Thank you. The recently elected Lord Mayor of the City of London Corporation begins his one-year term to promote the UK financial and professional services industry today. Alderman Alistair King will act as an international spokesperson for the City of London at what continues to be a very challenging time for the global economy. And he joins us now. Alderman King, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Your big theme then for the next year is called Growth Unleashed. How do you unleash that growth for the City of London, for the UK?
I think there are three elements. First is that we need to get some regulatory reform to help the city to be competitive. And that's something that I'll be working with the new government very closely in order to try and to achieve. I think perhaps the most important point is the second one, and that is mindset reform. Saying to British businesses in financial and professional services, don't wait for that regulatory reform to happen. Get on and do things now. Get on planes to go to around the world to the new growing markets. There are all sorts of opportunities there. Plus also invest in the new technologies that are available to us all. Last thing I think is to celebrate the extraordinary communities that we have here in the financial and professional services from all around the world. to celebrate them, plus also try to encourage them to do more here in the United Kingdom.
But you can bang that drum as hard as you like. You can make that case that people should be investing more. They should have a change of mindset. But if businesses haven't done that already, it's very hard to talk them into a new position.
Well, I don't agree. I think there are it's so much confidence involved in business. I think that there are the idea of giving businesses as a helping hand to go off to find new markets. I think that can really make a real difference.
London has only attracted 10 IPOs this year, including Raspberry Pi, Applied Nutrition, who we spoke to earlier this week, and potentially the French media company Canal Plus. Is it gearing up, or should more be done to attract investors?
I think more obviously needs to be done in relation to attractive investors. Having said that, I think that there has been a lot of work done over the last couple of years or so. There's the Capital Markets Industry Task Force, which I think has made some great gains in relation to getting a better regulatory framework. We've seen the prospectuses revised, plus also I think the rules in relation to listing. That's really been improved over the last couple of years. I think there's a great opportunity for new listings to come up. And also I think our pipeline is stronger than it has been for many years.
What needs to change then? What would ensure that strong pipeline results in listings here in London rather than listings in other countries?
I go back to my point in relation to confidence. I think there's a good deal of London has an extraordinary good platform in relation to good rule of law. We've got a stable government. We've got all sorts of stars are aligning in relation to London. I think it just needs a dollop of confidence to kick things off.
And did last week's budget provide that dollop of confidence?
I mean, I think there were some good elements in there. There was also some more challenging ones. I think there's something that we'll be working with the government on. But I just think it wasn't quite as bad as some people have thought it was going to be beforehand. And I think that we have to work with the government to make sure that future reforms are forthcoming.
Alderman Alistair King, thank you very much.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, we've had a couple of key interest rate decisions in the last 24 hours. As expected, the Bank of England has cut interest rates for the second time this year, taking the base rate down from 5% to 4.75%. And in the same 24 hours, the Fed, which is America's central bank, cut interest rates by a quarter percentage point. I'm joined by Kathleen Brooks, who's research director at the financial trading platform XTB. Kathleen, morning.
Good morning, Christy.
For the UK, then, this was the first decision since the government's budget and the first since the US election. Do we know if those events have had an impact on what the bank is thinking?
Well, it has, yes. So the budget hit was essentially an increase in inflation, and that was reflected in their forecasts. But I think the other thing that hasn't been mentioned as much is the fact that they did revise down their growth forecast for this year, which has nothing to do with the budget. But actually, in the future, our growth rate is expected to be lower than both the US, but also the Eurozone as well. So a lot of borrowing from this budget, but not much growth. I think ultimately the message from Bailey was that, we want inflation to stay close to target. There is an inflationary impulse from this budget. So it does allow the Bank of England to take their time over rate cuts. But it definitely, from both central banks, the Federal Reserve as well, the budget and US politics, they undoubtedly complicate things for global central bankers.
Now, one thing that complicates things for global central bankers is, of course, inflation. Sainsbury's chief executive has said prices are likely to rise after that increase, likely to increase after the rise in employers' national insurance contributions in last week's budget. In fact, Sainsbury's joins a growing chorus of big businesses. We've had M&S, BT, Wetherspoons, all hinting at price rises. Do they have much scope to hike prices when so many customers are still feeling the pinch?
Well, the changes in national insurance will hit Sainsbury's to the tune of 140 million and these other very large employers in the retail industry. So, there is a limit to how much they can suck up. They're also going to face price increases themselves from their suppliers. So they did say that they would have to make tough decisions. Now, some of that will be cost increases, but others could actually be unemployment. Now, that wasn't reflected in the Bank of England forecast, actually. They seem to suggest that the budget measures would actually have a fairly minimal impact on the economy, not a particularly large increase in inflation or unemployment. But I think what we're hearing on the ground is that this could have an impact. Now, whether or not that's just a bit of political positioning by these very large, powerful retail companies, we'll have to wait and see.
Okay, and very briefly, Nissan has announced an emergency turnaround plan after unveiling losses. It's talking about 9,000 job cuts and a 20% cut to global production. We don't know if that's going to affect the UK workforce. They haven't responded. Very briefly, what's going on? Will this turnaround plan work?
Well, it's another struggling car company that's not German. It's a real structural shift in car manufacturing. There's been a massive increase in Chinese cars and waning demand for EVs, and that's really hitting Nissan right now.
Kathleen Brooks, Research Director at financial trading platform XTB, thank you.
Fliss, thank you very much. Nearly 6:30. Mike Williams has this morning's sport.
Michelle, thank you. Good morning. Win, lose and draw for the British sides in the Europa League last night. Let's start at Old Trafford.
There is the final whistle. Ruud van Nistelrooy gets the job done once again. What a good shift he's put in as the interim coach. Manchester United fans will once again leave Old Trafford tonight with smiles on their faces. They're hoping that this is a team turning the corner.
For me, it's important now to carry on and build on results. First European win after 1 year. We addressed that in the dressing room and it was time to change that.
A second win in three matches for that man, Manchester United interim manager Ruud van Nistelrooy. His team beat the Greek side PAOK 2-0 in the Europa League last night. Ahmed Diallo with both goals. Elsewhere, not such a good night for Tottenham, who slipped to their first European defeat of the season, 3-2 away to Galatasaray, on what was a bittersweet night for the Spurs teenage forward Will Lankshire. He scored his first senior goal for the club, but was then sent off.
Will took his goal well, he worked hard for the team. He hasn't had a lot of experience at senior football, so I think he would have learnt a lot today. And that red card, you know, it was just a bit of over-enthusiasm in that moment to give away a foul, but he'll learn from that.
Tottenham manager Ange Postecoglou there refusing to criticise Lancashire for his red card. Meanwhile, in Glasgow, Rangers came from behind to rescue a point in a 1-1 draw with Olympiacos at Ibrox. So that's the Europa League. Plenty of British involvement in the Europa Conference League too. And we saw a cricket score at Stamford Bridge.
You don't get many of these. Chelsea 8, FC Noah 0. 6-0 at half-time. Nkunku twice went close before adding the 7th. The 8th, Dewsbury Hall, fouled by Ateki. And Nkunku dispatched the penalty. His 10th of the season, he still won't make the league team. They did have 15 shots tonight, Noah, but they were totally outclassed by Chelsea, who had 31 shots. They took 8 of them, and this is the biggest ever score in the Europa Conference League.
The BBC's John Southall reporting from Stamford Bridge after FC Noah of Armenia were put to the sword last night by a ruthless Chelsea. 8-0 the final score. Elsewhere, Hearts suffered their first loss in the Conference League this season. 2-0 at home to the Bundesliga side Heidenheim. The Welsh champions, the New Saints, also lost 2-1 away to Shamrock Rovers. And Larne are still waiting for their first ever point in European football. They took the lead against the Swiss side St Gallen at Windsor Park, but went on to lose 2-1. And briefly away from all that football, a line on the tennis for you this morning. The defending champion, Iga Świątek, has been knocked out of the WTA finals in Saudi Arabia, but Barbora Krejcikova beat Coco Gauff to secure her place in the semi-finals.
Mike, thank you very much indeed. Now, do you scare easily?
I'm Danny Robbins, and things are getting stranger in our trilogy of uncanny specials.
This was so beyond the realm of anything that I had ever experienced.
Episode 1 features the comedian and writer Stuart Lee.
Crossing the road walked a huge black dog. It turned to stare at him with the largest eyes like saucers.
And then step into a brand new investigation at Meadow Cottage.
In the corner, this thing just started laughing. It was eerie.
Listen to Uncanny on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
The time is now just after 6:30. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson, Michelle Hussein, Jane Steele with the news.
Donald Trump has made his first appointment of his future administration. His campaign manager, Susie Wiles, will be his White House chief of staff and the first woman to hold the post. Earlier, in an interview for NBC News, the president-elect reiterated his promise to carry out a mass deportation of illegal immigrants. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, says the government will try to persuade Mr. Trump that it is not in his interest to harm the UK by increasing tariffs on British exports to the United States. The president-elect has said he wants to increase tariffs on imported goods by 10%, rising to 60% on items from China. An independent review is calling for better access to vast amounts of NHS data that can be used to improve patient care and help research into conditions such as dementia, cancer and heart disease. The report says the NHS holds the medical details of tens of millions of people going back decades, but access to them can take many months or even years. England's chief medical officer said the report would help health leaders and researchers use data while maintaining confidentiality. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he is sending two rescue planes to the Netherlands to bring home Israeli football fans who were attacked in what he describes as a very violent incident. Local media in Amsterdam say there were numerous clashes in the city centre last night after a match between Maccabi Tel Aviv and Ajax. A pro-Palestinian protest was initially scheduled to take place near the stadium but was relocated. The acting Dutch Prime Minister has condemned the incident as unacceptable anti-Semitic attacks. The Azerbaijani authorities are facing questions after one of their senior officials, who's overseeing this year's UN conference on tackling climate change, was filmed offering to arrange a meeting about possible deals to exploit the country's oil and gas reserves. Elnur Sultanov was recorded secretly by an activist who posed as a potential investor. The climate conference COP29 starts in Baku on Monday. Prosecutors in Argentina have charged three people in connection with the death of the One Direction singer Liam Payne. They're all accused of helping access illegal drugs.
Jane, thank you very much. We could do much better in dealing with even common health conditions, a report out today says, if researchers had better access to the large amounts of health data gathered in the UK. Hugh Pym, our health editor, joins us. We'll be talking to the author of this report later on in the programme, Hugh. But essentially, what does it say the problem is?
Well, Michelle, Professor Kathy Sudlow led this review. She's an expert on health data and health data research. And it's an independent review. It's commissioned by health leaders, supported by the UK's chief medical officers. And it was looking at the opportunities that really are there, given the huge amount of data in the NHS and the nature of the NHS as a national system in the UK's four nations. And it goes on to say that the whole system is much too complex and inefficient, and it's actually getting in the way of using data to improve patients' experiences, and says actually waiting many, many months or even years for researchers can cost lives and get in the way of vital research on diseases like dementia and cancer. Now, it quotes examples. It says there are breast screening services, but they're not linked up with data on outcomes for breast cancer. Another example of good practice quoted in the report is what happened during the worst stages of the pandemic, when there was a lot more focus on research, and that threw up data on a very basic steroid, dexamethasone, which proved to be very effective in treating seriously ill patients in hospital with COVID. And the report says progress has really stalled since then, and there are a lot more opportunities which are going begging. And it comes up with a series of recommendations for better coordination of data, better data safety practices, and much more common practice around the UK.
Does this mean, Hugh, that we're not necessarily talking about longer-term drug development or long-term research? It's about how the NHS even uses immediate data itself. So outcomes for cancer patients feeding through immediately into how patients are treated or looked after at an earlier stage.
Yes, it says that there's data in lots of different silos around the NHS, for example, in GP practices, pharmacies, hospitals, and public health. And they're all there, but researchers can't always get access to different bits of them. GPs are concerned, understandably, about data security and often need more persuading that it's being used for the right reasons. And the report says patients actually are generally supportive of their data being used, subject to safeguards that they are anonymised data on their conditions. But it does say more work needs to be done on common data security systems, and also that health data should be treated as critical national infrastructure with much more focus on a whole range of security issues.
Hugh, thanks very much.
Let's turn now at 22 minutes to 7 to the paper's startling photograph on the front page of the Financial Times. Startling because it looks like a kind of family photo you get on a Christmas card. It is of the Trump family, or should we really call it the dynasty? Not just Donald Trump, his children and their partners and grandchildren, but the new addition Elon Musk and his son. He's looking very pleased indeed. We still don't know what job he will get. The Times tells us that Trump is eyeing a quick start with tariffs and tax cuts, saying that as well as putting tariffs on imports, Donald Trump plans to have tax breaks for companies that move their supply chains back into the United States. The newspaper describes it as a, quote, reordering of the global economic order.
I think that the child in Elon Musk's arms is one of his 12 children.
Just the 12?
Just the 12, yes. Standing at the edge of the Trump family photo. Elsewhere, the Telegraph has a picture of Nigel Farage and Baron Trump, President Trump's youngest child, on its front page. And also in this, more of this sense of how Keir Starmer's cabinet is, has been for months, trying to build bridges with the Trump campaign as it was then. Angela Rayner has spoken to J.D. Vance, the Telegraph says, in an effort to improve relations with the U.S. after she previously called Donald Trump a buffoon. The Deputy Prime Minister said she and the Vice President-elect discussed the special relationship in a phone call yesterday, and she said it was good to talk to Mr. Vance and that the pair talked about working together.
When our political editor Chris Mason reminded the Foreign Secretary David Lammy what he'd said about him, just a couple of words, deluded, dishonest, xenophobic, narcissistic, he described that as old news. You can hear that on Newscast. The other bit of news about this that we'll perhaps raise with our 8:10 guest this morning, which is the former head of MI6, is the headline in the eye, Trump could threaten to hold back intelligence from the UK, according to security sources.
The time is now 6:40. There were some startling figures in a report from the Gambling Commission, the industry regulator, yesterday. Tens of thousands of 11 to 17-year-olds have a gambling problem, they suggested. Those numbers were based on a rise from 0.7% of the overall population of young people affected last year to 1.5% today. What is going on? First to Declan Cregan, who works with the charity Gambling with Lives. As a teenager, he himself became addicted to gambling. Morning, Declan.
Good morning.
Tell us how it began for you.
Yeah, so for me, it began very, very small, a £1 roulette spin, winning £7.20 in my first spin. From that, things progressed very rapidly. And I kind of understood very, very quickly that I became addicted to gambling, and addicted to the very, very addictive products that the industry do have. Obviously from that £1 bet, things gradually became a lot more severe, turned into £100 bets, £1,000 bets. Over years, debt started, and things got gradually out of control, then mental health problems kicked in as well. It was a terrible, terrible time for me, 10 years of gambling.
You were 15, I think, at the time of that first £1 roulette spin. Do you remember how you came across it? Was it something that popped up, or did you go in search of a gambling website? What led you to that?
Yeah, I was 16 at the time, and a friend told me because he had seen it online, and basically I went in store then and had that first bet. I went in thinking absolutely nothing of it, that I was going in to have fun, because I was never ever warned while I was growing up that these products could be extremely addictive if I was to get hooked on them. So I had absolutely no idea what could potentially be the risks of this. So I didn't see a problem, and unfortunately, the problem did arise then in the end because, again, of the extremely addictive products that we do have in place.
And now that you work in this field, do you think with greater awareness in the more than decade since, because it's you said you're addicted for more than a decade and you're way beyond that now, are things better?
Slowly but surely, things are getting a little bit better. But for me, it's absolutely no shock with the recent figures. An industry spending $1.4 billion last year on gambling advertising. It's absolutely no shock to me or surprise that more and more young people, especially, are becoming addicted to gambling. Again, there's absolutely no reason for these young people to see a problem with gambling because, again, they're saying this 24/7. They all have mobile phones. They're saying it as a fun activity because of the way it is perceived on things like even Instagram, Facebook X. You know, this is all coming across like a fine activity to do. So again, there's no doubt in my mind that these figures, you know, there's no shock to me around these figures as well, because unfortunately it's in people's faces now 24/7.
Declan, thank you very much. And Ian Duncan-Smith, Conservative MP, is also with us. He chairs the all-party parliamentary group on gambling reform. Sir Ian, Declan making the point there about gambling advertising. Do you think we do need to do something more, or something more immediate, about sport in particular and football? There are still 11 Premier League clubs this season who will have a front-of-shirt gambling sponsor.
Without question. I mean, I think we're on the edge of a crisis. Remember, we're still dealing with a lot of the checks and balances, which are very few, that came from the original liberalisation all the way back to the last Labour government. But those days, we didn't have the online element. We now are in a world of incredibly smart technology. The gambling companies spend £1.5 billion on advertising, and they use ruthlessly apps and everything else to get to younger people. And they're rapacious. And the damage that's being caused is quite astonishing, really. But when you ask the public about the advertising, you get a very interesting response. A recent one said that 51% of all people think that gambling advertising, promotion, sponsorship should be banned. And 78% of the public think that nobody under the age of 18 should be exposed in any way to gambling advertising. So we've got a white paper which was left by the last government, which was good but not good enough, because it didn't really deal with the big problem over advertising, and they backed off a bit on that, and we had a row with them. And the present government seems to be taking its time over this, but we think it's urgent, but they should add the extra strength on real serious limits on gambling advertising, which is appalling.
The statement that we've had from the Department of Culture, Media and Sport recognises the impact harmful gambling can have on individuals and families. It says ministers are currently considering the best available evidence, including the Gambling Commission's recent statistics, and they say there'll be a full range of gambling policy updated in due course. The industry are big political donors, aren't they? They have been to the Conservatives, and they have been to and are to Labour as well, Labour candidates.
Yes, this is always a problem, really, because you've got to detach that sort of thing from your policy. The reality is, in the world of politics, you do run political parties without very much state intervention, if any at all, at times. So you do need to reach for money. But I would advise political parties to sup with a very long spoon on these companies. I think they are utterly rapacious. They don't care about the harms that they create. And the truth is, if we look at one simple fact, gambling companies make their money when you lose yours. And they're not interested in anyone that occasionally wins. They're only interested in those, I genuinely believe, that they can get fully addicted to this so that they lose money all the time. And one of the biggest areas is you see these young kids and others in their rooms late at night doing what they call the slots gambling, which is literally, you know, place a bet, place a bet, place a bet, do it now, do it now, do it now. And they get addicted to that, and then they lose thousands of pounds. Students at universities, we've got huge numbers of stories, losing their allowance for the year, which is going to put their borrowing up. All this sort of stuff is really where the government has got to crack down. As I said, there's a white paper. Government's got to get on with it. But they've got to add this real limit on advertising in football and all these other sports.
Ian Duncan-Smith and earlier Declan Cregan, thank you.
13 minutes to 7 now. Can, should Keir Starmer and Ed Miliband's dream of turning Britain into a clean energy superpower survive in the face of a new American president declaring that climate change is a green hoax and efforts to boost green energy are a scam? We're joined in the studio this morning by Greg Jackson, Chief Executive of Octopus Energy, not just the UK's second largest electricity and gas supplier, but he's one of those who's urged the government to, and I quote him, be brave and be fast in delivering a strong green economy. Morning to you, Mr. Jackson.
Good morning.
Can this government simply ignore the fact that America, one of the greatest polluters on the planet, will be now ripping up most of the promises to deliver what you called a strong green economy?
I mean, we can't ignore it. The reality is that while the US had made some very strong moves on climate change, you know, the Inflation Reduction Act sent seismic waves around economies in Europe, it didn't bring bills down. The most important thing we've got to do is bring people's bills down. And I think one in five Trump voters said they did so because of immigration. The number one reason they voted Trump was the economy. And I think, like, at the end of the day, people vote based on their quality of life. And, you know, clean power, renewables, are an opportunity to drop the cost of energy.
But this is interesting. You're saying that what happened to the Democrats is a warning to this government that merely investing a lot in green energy, worthwhile though that might be, morally praiseworthy though you might think it is, isn't going to work if people's bills don't come down.
I mean, that's the reality. By the way, we should say, you know, so much of the money from the Inflation Reduction Act went to incumbent industries. It went to things like carbon capture to enable the oil and gas industry to carry on doing what they do, but to capture the carbon. That puts bills up.
Instead, so you want it spent where?
Well, renewables are the cheapest form of electricity we've got. We've got the solutions to climate change, and they're cheaper than the fossil fuel world.
Well, they've been massively subsidised to get to where they are, aren't they? And they can't, of course, store the power that's produced. So they get a lot of wind when people don't want power, and there's no way of getting hold of it.
By the way, many people will be surprised, but the state in the US which has the most renewables is Texas. It's because in Texas you're really able to build stuff. And so even though it's the home of the oil and gas industry, in Texas you want the cheapest energy. You've got renewables, 72%.
Very sunny is presumably why it's got a lot of renewable energy.
And windy, which the UK is.
Yeah.
So the challenge in the UK is that at the moment, we keep building wind farms where the subsidies are highest and where it's windiest. And that means that, for example, you know, there's one new wind farm built off the north of Scotland in Shetland, where in the first month of operation, it was turned off 62% of the time. Because although it was windy, there wasn't much demand there. What we need to do is have market reform so that instead of companies being paid to turn off wind farms, people get cheap power.
Greg Jackson of Octopus Energy. Fascinating lesson for this government, potentially, from what's just happened in the United States. Thanks for joining us in the studio.
It is 10 to 7. Israel has so far failed to significantly turn around the humanitarian situation in Gaza, the State Department said this week. That's ahead of the November 13th deadline it had set Benjamin Netanyahu's government. We are, of course, now in a new international era with Donald Trump's re-election. But people in Gaza are continuing to live through an intense Israeli offensive, particularly in the north. Jan Egeland is the Secretary General of the aid organisation, the Norwegian Refugee Council, and he has just been in Gaza. Good morning, Mr. Egeland.
Good morning.
Tell us what you saw.
I saw a people left alone under the fiercest bombardment in an urban area with no escape in modern history. So I'm shattered, really. I'm ashamed of how the women and children and families of Gaza are bombarded and displaced and starved and besieged like the civilians were under Assad's Syria, when the West, the US, the UK and Germany were outraged by this cruelty. Where is the same outrage for those being besieged now, completely innocent civilians besieged in northern Gaza?
Are you speaking about the ongoing situation, or are you speaking particularly about the Israeli offensive in the north of Gaza? Could you get into that area?
I was able to travel around in Gaza and get also up to Gaza City, which is totally devastated. I mean, this would be Liverpool 25 times Liverpool Harbour after the Second World War. But northernmost governorate, we cannot enter. That's the besiegement within the besiegement, where people are strangled and starved so that they will leave. There will be then a buffer zone, and the settler movements, the settler mafias in across Israel are now celebrating because they want to colonize back Gaza. You can't make this up, really.
So are you saying you believe that is the Israeli plan, that Palestinians won't be able to return to their homes in northern Gaza?
They have been told in so many words now by the Israeli Defense Forces, get out immediately. We will not. We will starve you and we will bomb you. And there is no return. They've also been told they cannot return. What we do not know is if Israel would go ahead with colonizing in violation of every word in international law, northern Gaza, and that the poor Gazans will then be crammed into the smallest possible area on Earth, where they then are supposedly living on emergency relief for the rest of their lives. It cannot continue like this.
It's a war that Israel has said right from the beginning was sparked by the Hamas attacks last October, and that is designed at preventing Hamas ever doing anything like that again, and also getting the hostages back. You seem to be suggesting that it's a war against civilians.
We all want to fight terror. And those who were massacring Israelis on the 7th of October need to be brought to justice. They should never be allowed to do this again. But yes, this is no war against terror. This is no self-defense. This is the systematic destruction of Gaza. I've been there up and down. You, as a journalist, cannot go there. You could have gone to Syria, and you can go to Ukraine and other war zones. You are not allowed to be a witness because the destruction is so systematic and the violations of international law is so systematic. And if the US, the UK, Germany and others want to have a shred of moral authority again for the future, they cannot continue to call this self-defense and give arms to it.
Jan Egeland, head of the Norwegian Refugee Council, thank you.
It's now 5 to 7. A ban on children under 16 using social media, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook and others. That's what Australia's government is proposing. But some in the country are now beginning to warn that it is too blunt an instrument. Let's talk to Professor Amanda Third, who's a professorial research fellow at Western Sydney University. Good morning to you. London time, at least. Why might this be too crude a solution?
Oh, good morning. And yes, look, I do think it's a very crude solution. I think really what we are seeing is the government trying to hold technology companies to account for children and young people's safety and their mental health and well-being. But really the solutions that they're putting in place won't achieve that. And my very big concern is that the solution that they're proposing will indeed actually make children and young people more unsafe than they have been till now. Because I think what we're not thinking carefully enough about is the kinds of cultures or environments that we set up around, new policy and new legislation. If we want to hold technology companies to account, the worst thing we can do is evict children and young people from social media platforms, because then technology companies, in fact, have no incentive to design good spaces for children. And I think what we'll find is that technology companies begin to divert resources away from designing great products for children and, you know, move into compliance mode. So, you know, inject their funds into litigation. So really...
And do you also worry that young people will often manage some other way of getting onto social media illegally?
That's right. I mean, you know, adolescence is about breaking rules in lots of senses, isn't it? But I think, you know, in this instance, what I'm worried about is that because because children are not supposed to be there, nobody's looking after their needs, and the spaces that they'll end up landing in when they do indeed break the rules and find a way online are not going to be safe spaces. They're going to be more dangerous spaces. And I think we're not thinking clearly about the long-term implications of this policy. I think children will find it even harder to reach out for help when they run into trouble because they weren't supposed to be online in the first place. So, you know, I think we need a much more sophisticated approach rather than this blunt instrument of just blocking children.
Very interesting. Professor Amanda Third, thanks for joining us there from Western Sydney University.
Coming up next week on Radio 4, there will be drama set in the summer of 1914.
The Prime Minister was standing at the window.
Precipice.
by Robert Harris.
Thinking of Venetia.
An obsessive affair fuels dangerous behaviour.
He showed her a telegram from the ambassador in Berlin and afterwards tore it up and scattered the pieces out of the car window.
A threat to national security, with the country on the brink of war.
The notion that anyone might discover he was sending her secret telegrams was unthinkable. He blew her the ghost of a kiss.
Precipice by Robert Harris on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Next Monday to Friday night at 10:45.
Now at 2 minutes to seven, let's get the weather from Elizabeth Rizzini.
Thank you, Nick. Well, sunshine has been in very short supply, particularly across the south of England over the last few days. In fact, we've seen less than an hour of it for many spots since the 28th of October. But there was a lot of sunshine yesterday across northern Scotland. Again, this is well favoured for seeing some brighter skies again today. But for the rest of us, it's going to be gloomy and really very cloudy. Yet again, it's a bit chillier than it has been as well. Well, we're starting off the day, though, on a mild note again for this time of year. Temperatures in high single figures, low double figures. There's a bit of early mist and fog around as well. It's quite chilly across northern areas of Scotland where we've seen some breaks in the cloud through the night. A little bit of drizzle around for a time this morning, particularly for western coasts, just from the thickness of the cloud, really. But it is going to be mostly dry, very cloudy. Again, the low cloud just persisting and not quite as breezy as it was yesterday. Now, the best in the breaks of the cloud will probably be across northwest England and northwest Wales. Again, northern Scotland seeing the best of today's sunshine. Top temperatures for most of us between 9 and 12 degrees Celsius for England and Wales, 12 to 16 in Scotland and Northern Ireland.
Elizabeth, thank you very much. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Michelle Hussain.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Friday, the 8th of November. The headlines this morning. Donald Trump has begun selecting his new administration, picking Susie Wiles as his chief of staff. She'll be the first woman to serve in that role. The Israeli government is sending two military aircraft to the Netherlands to bring home football fans who were attacked in violence in Amsterdam last night. And there are calls for better access to vast amounts of NHS data to improve research into conditions such as dementia, cancer and heart disease.
Coming up before eight, Megyn Kelly, the anchor once called nasty by Donald Trump, on why she voted for him and on where this election leaves US news networks.
They've all been outed as such dishonest brokers. They openly declared war on the guy with the fascism lie that they peddled, such that they can never rebuild with the right half of the country.
And we travel along Stockport's canals, a proposed World Heritage site, with a Today programme listener.
Lots of people walking dogs here. You can hear the water going through the locks at the moment, which is a really nice sound, and just right in the middle of the town to be able to bring you back to nature.
The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
President-elect Donald Trump has made his first key White House appointment, naming Susie Wiles, one of his two campaign managers, as his new chief of staff. It's the first time in US history that a woman has taken that role. Traditionally, the chief of staff oversees the daily operations of the White House and advises the president on policy issues. Our North America correspondent Nadia Shafiq reports from Florida.
When Donald Trump delivered his victory speech on election night, one of the people he turned to on stage and credited for his win was Susie Wiles. The 67-year-old longtime political strategist, he said, liked to stay in the background. Now he's elevated her to one of the top jobs in the White House, where she will make history as the first woman to hold the title. In a statement, Mr. Trump described her as tough, smart, innovative, and universally admired and respected. In his first term, the former president went through four chiefs of staff who advised him on policy and day-to-day operations. This time around, he's looking to appoint loyalists to carry out his agenda. And one of his first priorities when he takes office, he's told NBC News in an interview, is to make the border strong and powerful. He said people must come in legally, and he had no choice but to carry out the largest mass deportation of illegal immigrants to secure the country, no matter the cost.
In his first interview since Donald Trump won the American presidential election, the Foreign Secretary David Lammy has told the BBC that criticisms he'd made of Mr. Trump in the past were old news and that he had felt in his bones that the president-elect would win for some months. Mr. Lammy was speaking to our political editor Chris Mason, who reminded him of some of the comments he had made.
So, April 2019, you said, deluded, dishonest, xenophobic, narcissistic, Donald Trump is no friend of Britain. Have you changed your mind, or is that still your view?
This is old news. Here, Chris, I'm sitting here as Foreign Secretary. I've had a meal with Donald Trump. I've met Donald Trump.
Did you talk about this stuff? Did you apologise? Did he bring it up?
Not even vaguely.
You can hear the full newscast interview with David Lammy on BBC Sounds. President Putin has praised Donald Trump in his first comments since the US election. Speaking in the Black Sea resort of Sochi, Mr. Putin said he had offered his congratulations to the president-elect, adding that he was ready to hold talks with him about the war in Ukraine. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg was watching.
Donald Trump will have absolutely loved what Vladimir Putin said about him. Speaking at a political discussion club in southern Russia, the Kremlin leader praised the way Trump had handled himself during the attempt on his life back in July and called him a courageous man. Then more praise for the US president-elect's stated desire to improve relations with Russia and help end the war in Ukraine. The Kremlin will be hoping to build a productive relationship with the Trump administration, one that does indeed help to end the Ukraine war on terms beneficial to Russia. Mr. Putin added that he was ready for discussions with Donald Trump.
The Israeli government has announced it is sending two military aircraft to Amsterdam to bring home fans of Maccabi Tel Aviv football club after what it described as a very violent incident against them. They were in the Netherlands to watch their team play the Dutch side Ajax in the Europa League. Our correspondent Joan Wood is in Jerusalem.
Videos on social media show people being beaten unconscious. One appears to show a man in a canal being told to say Free Palestine. Israel's far-right National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir said fans had been met with unimaginable cruelty just because of their Jewishness and Israeliness. The government in Jerusalem announced two planes would be sent for what it called a rescue mission. But there are also multiple videos showing a crowd tearing down a Palestinian flag from a street in central Amsterdam, with anti-Palestinian chants audible in the background. The sequence of events is not yet certain. What is clear is that they were about much more than just football rivalry.
A report is calling for better access to vast amounts of NHS data that can be used to improve patient care and help research into conditions such as dementia, cancer and heart disease. The review says the NHS holds medical details for tens of millions of people going back decades, but access to them can take many months or even years. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
The independent review led by Professor Cathy Sudlow concluded that the potential benefits from the large amount of health data in the UK were not being maximised. Research about common health conditions, she said, was too often prevented or delayed because systems for accessing the available information were too complex and patients were being let down. Professor Sir Chris Whitty, England's chief medical officer, said that the report should help health leaders and researchers use data more effectively for patients while maintaining confidentiality.
An Azerbaijani official overseeing this year's UN conference on tackling climate change has been filmed offering to arrange meetings to discuss potential oil and gas deals. Elnor Sultanov was recorded secretly by human rights activists ahead of the COP29 meeting, which starts in Baku on Monday. Our climate editor Justin Rowlett has seen the footage.
We have a lot of gas fields that are to be developed, the COP29 chief executive Elnor Sultanov tells the potential investor in the video. He offers to set up a meeting with the Azerbaijani state oil and gas company SOCAR. The man is actually a representative of the human rights organization Global Witness. Attempting to do business deals as part of the COP process appears to be a serious breach of the standards of conduct expected of a COP official. Neither the Azerbaijani COP29 team or SOCAR responded to our request for comment.
The managing director of Harrods has personally apologised for the first time following the sexual abuse allegations which have been made against the store's former owner, Mohammed Al-Fayed, who died last year. The BBC approached Michael Ward at Harrods headquarters, where he said he was sorry for what had happened. Ellie Price reports.
I am very dreadfully sorry for what has happened with Al-Fayed. The words of Michael Ward speaking in person for the first time about sexual abuse allegations against his old boss, Harrods' former owner, Mohammed Al-Fayed. Hundreds of women have alleged the billionaire raped or sexually abused them. Harrods says it's engaged in a settlement process with more than 290 women, and there are also separate legal claims being brought against the luxury department store. Michael Ward has been managing director of Harrods since 2005 and worked alongside Al-Fayed until 2010, when new owners bought the business. He has previously said he did not know of any abuse and that no formal complaints have been brought to him, although rumours of Al-Fayed's behaviour were in the public domain.
An NHS lung cancer screening programme that uses mobile clinics to visit local communities in England has detected the disease in more than 5,000 people since 2019. Most of them were at the earliest stage of the disease. Under the scheme, specially adapted lorries visit supermarkets, football grounds and town centres in areas where lung cancer rates are high and offer current and past smokers a scan of their lungs. The plan is to roll out the scheme across England by 2030. The Prince of Wales has described the past year as the hardest year of his life. Speaking to reporters at the end of his visit to South Africa, Prince William talked about how he has coped after his wife and his father were diagnosed with cancer. The heir to the throne said he was proud of both Princess Catherine and the King. An initiative to save and restore one of Scotland's native trees has been launched in the Highlands. Aspens play a crucial role in local ecosystems and help build resilience against climate change, but they're becoming increasingly rare.
Jane, thank you. It is 9 minutes past seven now. He's a courageous man. He behaved like a man. Thus, Vladimir Putin praised Donald Trump yesterday before declaring, "We're ready. We're ready to talk to him." The Russian president, who the FBI concluded had tried to interfere in Trump's first election campaign 8 years ago, was speaking in Sochi through a translator.
His behaviour when there was an attempt on his life, you know, I was impressed. He's a courageous person.
I've been speaking to Stephen Pfeiffer, former US ambassador, senior fellow at former US ambassador to Ukraine, I'm sorry, and senior fellow at the Brookings Institute, about what he made of what Putin had had to say.
I think that the Russians were pleased with the result of the American election on Tuesday. And I think that Mr. Putin is sending a signal that he looks forward to some kind of contact with the president-elect, although he's trying to be careful not to appear too much the demandeur.
What's the worst case scenario in your view for Ukraine now?
Well, I worry about the fact that over the last 8 or 9 years, the president-elect has rarely, if ever, criticized Mr. Putin or Russian actions. He seems to have an affinity for the Russian president. And if you look at his record with Ukraine during his first term, he only had one real interaction with the Ukrainians, and that was to try to persuade the Ukrainian president, or to extort the Ukrainian president, into interfering in the American political process. Over the past several years, he has not been a particular supporter of Ukraine, even after the all-out Russian invasion in 2022. So while Mr. Trump is unpredictable, I worry that he could end American assistance to Ukraine in 2025, and that would be very welcome in the Kremlin.
Are, yes, say, supporters of Trump, like our own former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who is a big friend of Ukraine and of Zelensky. But look, Trump did, he argues, provide the weapons that Ukraine needed. So judging by what he does, not what he says, goes the argument.
Yeah, he provided a relatively small amount of man-portable anti-armor missiles after, I think, some persuasion by his staff. But if you look over the last year, when the question of another supplemental from Congress has come up to support Ukraine, and we were talking about a $40 billion bill, he was very critical of that. And so I'm not confident that he would be prepared to authorize additional American support in 2025 for Ukraine. I hope I'm wrong on that.
Now, some say, look, everyone knows this war will have to end in a negotiation, so why not one sooner rather than later, with Trump, yes, wooing Putin, because he needs to woo the guy he's got to do a deal with.
I believe at some point there will be a negotiation between the Ukrainians and the Russians. But if you look at the Russian position now, it's simply not serious. It amounts to total Ukrainian capitulation. And you've seen over the last 2.5 years, Russian demands actually escalate, even though their military is bogged down on the battlefield.
So what should Europe do? What should the rest of NATO do if you fear that a Trump presidency will undermine Ukraine?
Well, I believe Europe should try to engage their president-elect to try to persuade him that, yes, it is in the interest of the United States as well as Europe that Ukraine continue to be able to resist Russian aggression. But at the same time, I think Europe should be coming up with a plan B. What will Europe do if American assistance ends and that burden then shifts entirely to Europe?
Do you think there's a wider threat? In other words, NATO is based on the principle that an attack on one is an attack on all. Are you confident that if Russia were to make a move against another country, that America under Donald Trump would be there?
I'm not as confident as I wish I were. If you go back and you look at several points over the last 8 months, Mr. Trump has said that if certain allies have not paid, he would not defend them. I worry that that's a message to Mr. Putin that perhaps aggression against NATO could be a possibility without American intervention. And we've already seen Mr. Putin make this huge miscalculation when he ordered the all-out invasion of Ukraine in 2022. I'd hate to see him make another miscalculation like that. I'd like to see an American president who says, as President Biden said, as President Obama said, we will defend every inch of NATO territory because that's likely to deter the Russians.
Stephen Pfeiffer, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, thank you for joining us.
It is 14 minutes past seven. There's a report out today suggesting that the number of people starting new jobs has fallen at its fastest rate since March. Fliss is back, having looked at it. Fliss?
Hello, yes. The new research is from KPMG and the Recruitment and Employment Confederation, and it shows there was a slowdown in hiring in October. It seems that some firms introduced recruitment freezes in the run-up to the budget. And many of the tax rises, of course, announced by the Chancellor impact businesses, including that rise in national insurance contributions for employers. Let's talk to Andrew Murphy, who's chief executive of the toy shop chain The Entertainer, which has 166 stores in the UK and 2,000 employees. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning.
Have you had to change any of your business plans, any of your hiring plans?
Sadly, yes. And it's fair to say that I think many retailers took a little bit of fright during October in the run-up to the budget. And unfortunately, for retail, the news was bad. The two specific examples that I'd pull out that have changed in our planning, we had been looking at opening two new shops and had done what we would call the viability assessment on those, assessing the likely sales and the likely costs of those. They had passed those tests. We were just about to initiate that work. And unfortunately, the changes to national insurance in particular just tipped that balance. And so those stores will now not be opening. We've also imposed a hiring freeze in our head office because the general cost environment versus the consumer demand that we're seeing is just unfavourable at the moment. So we're definitely taking stock.
Well, the government says that the decisions outlined in the budget mean more than half of employers will either see a cut or no change in their national insurance bills, and that workers' payslips will be protected from higher tax. What's your response to that?
I think that's a very partial analysis, and I mean that in both senses of that word. If I give you the example of a 20-hour retail employment contract, and we have many of those, and if listeners are wondering, well, why do you have 20 hours rather than, say, 40 or 37? Sometimes you simply need more than one human being in the shop at one time. And so having one 40-hour person doesn't quite cut it. For those people, the increase in the national insurance element of their cost is almost 200%. It's a triple whammy on the flexibility of labour, because you have national minimum wage moving up, you have the floor for NI falling, and you have the rate of national insurance moving up at the same time.
Briefly though, Andrew, businesses will eventually benefit from investment in infrastructure, in NHS and education.
There's no argument with the government's ultimate goals, simply the balance with which they pursued them, with fuel duty being frozen for the 15th year in a row and no sign of an online sales tax. It seems that the government are reluctant to commit to pushing employment and pushing placemaking, two things that everybody in the UK cares about.
Andrew Murphy, Chief Executive of The Entertainer, thank you very much.
Fliss, thank you. 17 minutes past seven. Probably the hardest year of my life, Prince William has said of 2024, reflecting in a way that we don't often see from the royals, on a time when both his wife and his father have faced cancer and when he remains estranged from his only sibling. He was speaking to reporters at the end of his visit to South Africa. The Daily Mail's Robert Hardman joins us. He has just published a new edition of his book, Charles III, New King, New Court. Morning, Robert. Welcome back.
Good morning, Michelle.
There are other striking words in what he said to reporters in South Africa, that it's been a dreadful year. And from a personal family point of view, what they've been through has been brutal, he said. What did you make of him speaking in those terms?
Yeah, I thought it was a very significant intervention, not least because it's not normally the sort of thing we hear from the Prince of Wales, from Prince William. I mean, his brother obviously has been very vocal about his sort of personal feelings in recent years. Prince of Wales usually prefers to keep these things to himself, and self-evidently it has been a hell of a year, particularly, you know, for him. There he is, on the one hand, helping his wife through this, you know, very serious illness, at the same time expected to stand in for his father, who equally is suffering from cancer. And, you know, earlier on in the year, of course, there were all the sort of slightly unhinged sort of social media conspiracy theories, you know, where is Kate and all that. And then suddenly she appeared in public to explain that she had cancer. And he's been sort of, you know, he's been holding the fort through all this. And there he is in South Africa with his Earthshot Prize, which I think he regards as one of his great achievements. It is the sort of the biggest environmental prize in the world. And and this was unscripted. I don't think he sort of went out there with a plan to say this, but talking to reporters, I think he just felt, you know, he wanted to make the point that, yeah, you know, that the whole family's been through an extraordinary year.
From his childhood, and not least through the time when his mother was killed, he's had a difficult relationship with the press. And I wonder if you think that this is the start of something new, that he's going to try to present himself in a more human, in a more open, in a more personal way, because he is also going to have to get used to increased scrutiny, isn't he? I mean, we're just a few days on from Channel 4 and the Sunday Times reporting about his wealth and the King's wealth, including that they receive millions of pounds of income in rent from charities, the NHS, parts of the armed forces.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that goes with the territory, I think. I mean, I think there is always been a sort of slight tendency to sort of view Prince William through the sort of as this sort of apprentice who's still learning the ropes. But actually, I mean, he's now been at the heart of international public life for over a decade. I mean, I was noticed when he was on the standing in for the King at the D-Day commemorations back in June on the beach alongside the President of the US, President of France. You know, he's been in that world, meeting those sort of people for a lot longer than some of the other world leaders there. So, you know, he is an experienced sort of statesman in his own right. But, you know, as you say, from time to time, the royal family do have to take flak. I mean, you know, there is a case where, you know, like every other family estate, like most pension funds, like the Church of England, you know, these ancient institutions own land, they rent out that land. But, you know, when it's the royal family, obviously it comes under greater scrutiny, even if it is all of it actually governed by the government. There's even a cabinet minister called the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster. So, you know, these are complex issues, but often presented in very straightforward headline ways. But I do have a sense that this intervention, it does sort of mark a kind of reset for the monarchy. You know, it has, as you say, Michelle, I mean, it's been a really significant, really tough year for all of them. But I just think in the last few weeks, we have had a sense of sort of resetting the dial. There's the King out in Australia with the Commonwealth Summit. There's Prince William's had his documentary about homelessness out. The Queen Camilla's got a very powerful documentary on domestic violence next week, and we'll see the whole family on parade at the Cenotaph on Sunday. So I think there's a sort of sense that not quite sort of putting it all behind them, but I think sort of getting the show back on the road.
Robert Hardman, thank you.
It's coming up to 22 minutes past seven now. Kew Gardens, Durham Cathedral, Edinburgh Newtown, the Giant Causeway are all on UNESCO's World Heritage List. Now there's a campaign to have a mile-long stretch of canal with 16 locks added to that list. It's in Marple, in Greater Manchester, and a local MP who's leading the call has said it's an extraordinary testament to our industrial and engineering heritage. In a moment, we'll hear from the man who runs the Canal and River Trust. Though first, though, here's our listener Claire, who lives nearby and sent us this from one of her regular walks along the canal.
I've just finished work and arrived at the top of the 16 locks in Marple. I spend a lot of time up here because I go to Marple Girl Guiding, where I'm a leader, and we're right at the top of the locks where the Peak Forest Canal and the Macclesfield Canal meet. So I'm walking down. It's really nice because there are still people living on the canal boats. You can see the lights twinkling from the boats, which is really nice in the evening. We're really lucky because the canal goes all the way sort of down. We've got countryside to the side, but then we can walk from here straight to the shops in a couple of minutes. In the summer and in the daytime, quite often you can see people going through the locks, and they're really good. They let people help them. Often kids are there. So my kids once were on the lock helping people and actually found out they had a little sister. So we've all got lots of tales to tell, but mine is that my kids found out they had a baby sister when they were helping on one of the locks. Lots of people walking dogs here. You can hear the water going through the locks at the moment, which is a really nice sound, and just right in the middle of the town to be able to bring you back to nature is really good. So I can see down a lot of the locks. Can't see as far as the aqueduct, but it's just a really lovely place to spend your time.
We've got a picture of it there, didn't we? Richard Perry is chief executive of the Canal and River Trust, which is a charity that was set up to take over from what used to be called British Waterways, a publicly owned body, to run our canals and rivers. Good morning to you. Tell us a bit more about this, why this 1 mile stretch of canal isn't just another bit of canal, is particularly special.
Morning, Nick. It really is. And that was lovely to hear Claire talking so passionately about it. One of millions of people who use and love their local canals. And it really is stunning in Marple because it starts, if I take the northern end, where the canal crosses the River Goyt over an amazing aqueduct. The Marple Aqueduct is grade one listed. It's the highest aqueduct in England. There's a viaduct that runs alongside to make it even more spectacular. And as soon as you cross the aqueduct, you enter the lock flight. And it's not one of the lock flights that's like a staircase car into the hillside. Rather, it sort of reveals itself slowly as you climb. It curves, and the 16 locks beautifully spaced. And as you heard from Claire, as you approach the centre of the town, the locks get closer together, and suddenly you're in the middle of Marple at the top of this wonderful lock flight. It really is stunning.
It is that combination, isn't it? A beautiful countryside and extraordinary Victorian engineering.
It absolutely is. And we know that people value their heritage. They really value the chance to be close to nature, as Claire said. And of course, our role as the charity, as you said, is to have to care for it in perpetuity. And the real challenge to that is the cost of maintaining it. We've had to rebuild three of the locks in Marple over the last few years. And that cost is over £1 million every time. And it's really the pressure on our funds to ensure that this wonderful heritage that delivers so much benefit today can be cared for all of us to enjoy.
Yes, we often get down to money. And that's the reason this came to our attention. A local MP, the MP for Hazelgrove, Lisa Smart, raised it in the House of Commons and said that what she sees as Tory cuts, but it seems to me, I think I'm right in saying the Labour government is continuing with, will mean you're getting £300 million less than you wanted.
Yes, that's right, Nick. Look, we're very keen to have a partnership with government. We know the benefits of canals are clear to so many people, for nature, for the heritage, but also for the role they play in water security, for nature recovery, for flood alleviation even. So there's lots of benefit that they provide. Mm. But Biyara Charity, people can make their own donations to us. We have over 30,000 friends. And for everyone who loves their local canal, you know, I would urge them to support us, to make a donation if they can, and to very much celebrate what they have on the doorstep. That's such a miracle, really. Over 220 years after the canal was built, it's still there, being used by boats and enjoyed by more people than ever.
Last thought. That's what you've got to do, isn't it? You've got to raise more money. You're never going to get it from the government. They haven't got enough money to do the things that are their top election priorities. So they're not going to give more money to canals, are they? You're going to have to raise it in different ways.
Well, we very much want to be able to raise it from a whole variety of sources, Nick. We want to continue the conversation with government because we know how vital it is that canals continue to be supported. They deliver so much benefit. We estimate £6 billion of benefit are delivered by our canals, and that's worth a lot to government. But yes, as a charity, we do appeal to the public to support us. We use the canals for lots of new, innovative ways of generating income as well. But the plea to the public is very much, please support our work so we can keep our canals open and alive for everyone to enjoy forever and ever.
And if you get the chance, go to Marple Lock. You might end up in the great town of Macclesfield. Not why.
we're doing this item. Wasn't my suggestion, but as it happens, you end up in the right place.
You can take me there yourself.
Yes, I look forward to it.
27 minutes past seven. Mike's here.
I've been to Marple Lock. My auntie lives in Marple. Ah. Very fond memories of walking that stretch of canal.
Glorious,
as a young lad. Let's start with football, though, this morning, because Stop Press, for the first time in over a year, Manchester United have won a match in Europe.
Hammer! Two goals for Ahmad. It's the Ahmad Diallo show for Manchester United tonight in Old Trafford.
Yes, two goals from the young Ivorian forward Ahmad Diallo. The second of those, as you just heard, particularly eye-catching, helped Manchester United to a 2-0 victory over the Greek side PAOK in the Europa League at Old Trafford. It is United's first win in any European competition since October 2023. Elsewhere, there was a first European defeat of the season for Tottenham. They had a man sent off and lost 3-2 away to Galatasaray, whilst in Glasgow, Rangers drew 1-1 with Olympiacos. Meanwhile, Chelsea were in Europa Conference League action last night. They took on the Armenian side FC Noah, and unfortunately the floodgates opened on them. 8-0 the final score at Stamford Bridge.
In my opinion, the way to show respect to them is don't underestimate them, otherwise you don't respect them. And this is was the message before the game. Guys, don't underestimate nothing, because football is full of this kind of surprise. So be serious, be professional, and they have done perfectly.
That is the Chelsea manager, Enzo Maresca. Elsewhere, Hearts suffered their first loss in the Conference League this season, 2-0 at home to the Bundesliga side Heidenheim. Welsh champions, the New Saints, also lost 2-1 away to Shamrock Rovers. Defeat 2 for Laon, who were beaten 2-1 by the Swiss side St Gallen at Windsor Park. Next to Rugby Union, and the second weekend of the Autumn Nations series gets underway this evening with a big match in Dublin. Ireland host New Zealand. Now, the Irish are enjoying a bit of a purple patch against the All Blacks, with 5 victories over them in the last 8 years. So what chance of another one this evening? Here is the Ireland number 8, Caelan Doris.
Yeah, I think when you break new ground in terms of getting a win against them, you know you can do it, and it becomes, there's more belief off the back of that. It's not this thing that you've never gotten near or never beaten before. And so of course there's still massive respect, because you have to respect them given how good they are, but there's also more belief, definitely.
And you can listen to Ireland against New Zealand live from Dublin on 5 Live this evening from 10 past 8. Finally, tennis, and defending champion Iga Świątek has been knocked out of the WTA finals in Saudi Arabia. The Wimbledon champion Barbora Krejcikova, though, beat Coco Gauff to secure her place in the semi-finals. Leave you with this bit of fun for a Friday. Arguably the biggest revelation to come from that match is that the Czech player Krejcikova has admitted that her and her team have been preparing for matches out in Saudi Arabia by devising a dance routine to ABBA's Dancing Queen.
It was a nice song to dance. We've been doing like a little, it's not really a dancing, but we have fun all together, and I'm glad it helped.
Any chance we get to see the dance?
No.
At the end? Okay, just checking.
I would have to work much more on it, and I think I would get more nervous than playing the matches, so no thank you.
There you go. That is the exclusive. Barbora Krejcikova will not be channeling her inner Theresa May and dancing to ABBA Dancing
that
Queen.
That is your challenge.
to get her to do that
on camera.
She has danced her way into the semi-finals, though, where she will be in action later today.
Look forward to it.
On BBC iPlayer.
Of all the wonderful places in the world, one continent holds more riches than any other. Asia has the world's highest mountains, the hottest place on the Earth's surface, the richest concentration of marine life, a trillion trees, and more people than in the rest of the world combined.
Asia, with David Attenborough.
There's nowhere else on Earth with so many untold stories.
Watch on BBC iPlayer.
The weather mostly dry and cloudy today, but bright skies in northern Scotland.
Coming up in a few minutes, we're going to be discussing the collapse of Germany's government, hearing from voters in Berlin, and speaking to an ally of the finance minister who's pushed out of Olaf Scholz's government, perhaps before he jumped.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4, where Jane Steele has a summary of the news. Donald Trump has announced that his campaign manager, Susie Wiles, will be his White House chief of staff, the first woman to hold the post. It's the first appointment he's made for his future administration since he won the election.
Earlier, Mr. Trump told NBC News that one of his first priorities would be to stop migrants arriving across the southern border and to carry out the largest mass deportation of illegal immigrants in US history. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, has told the BBC that Mr. Trump is someone that we can build a relationship with in our national interest because we must. Asked about comments he made in 2019 describing Mr. Trump as deluded, dishonest, xenophobic and narcissistic, Mr. Lammy said that was old news. The Dutch Prime Minister, Dick Schoof, says he was horrified by attacks on Israeli football fans in Amsterdam last night. The violence occurred after a Europa League game between Maccabi Tel Aviv and Ajax. Mr. Schoof said he had spoken with his Israeli counterpart, Benjamin Netanyahu, to assure him that the perpetrators would be tracked down and prosecuted. Mr. Netanyahu says he's sending two military aircraft to bring the fans home. An independent review is calling for better access to vast amounts of NHS data that can be used to improve patient care and help research into conditions such as dementia, cancer and heart disease. The report says the NHS holds the medical details of tens of millions of people going back decades, but access to them can take many months or even years. England's chief medical officer said the report would help health leaders and researchers while maintaining confidentiality. The Azerbaijani authorities are facing questions after one of their senior officials, who's overseeing this year's UN conference on tackling climate change, was filmed offering to arrange a meeting about possible deals to exploit the country's oil and gas reserves. Elnur Sultanov was recorded secretly by an activist who posed as a potential investor. The climate conference, COP29, starts in Baku on Monday.
Jane, thank you. 26 minutes to 8 now. Those who fear a second Trump term in the White House argue that it's never been more important for Europe to have strong leadership. Just one problem, though. The engine of Europe is slowly grinding to a halt. Germany's economy is in crisis and its government is on the brink of collapse after the German Chancellor, the Social Democrats Olaf Scholz, fired his finance minister, the Free Democrats Christian Lindner, after a long-running row in the governing three-party coalition about the budget. It leaves Scholz without the votes he needs to govern. An election looks likely sooner rather than later. In a moment, we'll be talking to an ally of the former finance minister. But first, Berlin-based journalist James Jackson went onto the streets of Berlin for us to hear views on what's been happening.
Well, to be honest, it was such a difficult day yesterday with the US presidential elections, and then it escalated here in Germany as well. I think it's a bit of a shock still, because it can push the right-wing party, AfD, a bit higher, because if we have new elections, it's very difficult to think about that.
I just think they were in political deadlock. I think it's a good thing that the ample is done.
I think it's very exciting that sleepy Schultz is finally doing something, honestly. It's moving in the right direction.
Life will go on for the CDU.
And are you worried about the AfD as well?
No, not for the not for Germany. No, AfD is only in the East.
I think it was about time and away, but maybe the day was not the best day to decipher it, because there had been global upheaval.
I mean, on the one hand side, I think it was the right step. It was the right thing to do. He's been blocking them. He was not acting in a good way for quite a long time. On the other hand, I'm quite fearful, because I don't know what that means in terms of new parties coming into power, and I'm talking about right-wing parties.
Better Merz than sleepy Schulz. Yeah. Sleepy Olaf.
Sleepy Olaf is being criticised there, and they're talking about Merz. He's the leader of the Christian Democrats, the CDU, who are on course, if there's an early election, to win it, according to the opinion polls, amidst worries that you heard repeatedly there that the far-right AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland, could benefit from any election. Well, let's talk to Alexander Müller now, chair of the Bundestag, the German Parliament's Defence Committee, and an MP from the Liberal FDP party, the Free Democrats, and therefore an ally of the man who was sacked, Mr. Müller, or was he preparing to leave the government and therefore Olaf Scholz acted quickly?
It was a small surprise, but of course it showed it was foreseeable. The common ground that this coalition had was exhausted. And it was a question of time. Christian Lindner also said this is the autumn of decisions. It was clear that something fundamentally would have to happen. Either we would agree on a good path fiscally, or it would break up. And now it broke up. Yes, we'll have a new election soon.
In a sense, no real surprise, is it? The Free Democrats for decades have been a free market party that have argued for lower tax. And you went into coalition with a high spending, high tax, high borrowing Social Democrat party. What does it mean, though, for crucial decisions like German funding for the war in Ukraine?
Oh, that is a good question. That was one of the things why the coalition broke up. Of course, we as Free Democrats, we stand for support for Ukraine. And the Chancellor, you know, on the very first day of the war, he wanted to donate 5,000 helmets. And we discussed a year with him to send tanks to Ukraine. And he was reluctant. And still today, we want the Taurus rockets to go to Ukraine. And he's reluctant. So this is also a question we are struggling. And it's not clear how we will support Ukraine until there will be new elections.
But now, he says you're not willing to foot the bill for the things that you asked for.
What did we, the bill?
He says you're not willing to pay the bills, in other words, to sanction the spending that is necessary.
That was a bad excuse, because German constitution says if you want to expend over the debt break, you have to have a good reason. And he offered us a reason to spend 3 billion for Ukraine and 12 billion in his usual budget. And this would not work. Our constitution does not allow this. And so this was just a bad excuse from Olaf Scholz.
Now, there's a question about how soon you have elections, whether it's pretty much straight away in the beginning of next year or in the spring. Do you want very early elections now? And if they come, is it inevitable that the Christian Democrats win and that you, the Free Democrats, just switch sides? You move from a coalition of the left to a coalition of the right?
Oh, many questions. The first things, yes, it would be good for the country now to have very soon the elections. But our constitution says it all lies in the hands of Olaf Scholz now. He has to make the, how is it called in English, the trust question is the translation. It's the only way how we can have new elections. And he said he will make this trust question in mid-January.
I think technically we call that the vote of confidence, a vote of confidence in the parliament.
Vote of
the
confidence, trust also a good translation, yeah. Yes. And he will not have the confidence in mid-January. And that makes the way clear for new elections, which will then happen within 60 days, says our constitution. So we expect March for new elections.
Mr. Müller, Conservatives, a final thought to you, if I may. This is a interesting conversation about a powerful country we care about in Europe, but it matters a whole lot more because Donald Trump has just been elected. Is Germany incapable of now giving Europe the leadership that it craves?
I think Olaf Scholz was 3 years incapable of giving Europe the leadership, especially in the terms of Ukraine war. And so I hope for a new chancellor which will take this leadership role for Germany now.
And will the far right get quite a foothold in the next German parliament?
That is a question where we, as democratic parties of the center, will have to work on that we hinder them to gain more ground in the parliament.
Alexander Müller, thank you very much for talking to us. Look forward to talking to you again when and if those elections are held.
It is now 19 minutes to 8. One of the most striking appearances at a Trump rally in the last days of the election campaign was that of Megyn Kelly, former Fox News anchor, someone who had clashed with Donald Trump in the past. There she was giving him her full-throated support. She now has a podcast called The Megyn Kelly Show and had just finished speaking to Donald Trump Jr., the president-elect's son, when Justin spoke to her last night.
Well, I mean, Don was saying that this did not come as a surprise to anybody on Team Trump, that their internal polls were showing Trump up all along considerably. But it turns out they did better even with the urban vote than they ever anticipated. So that was one. Two, I asked him whether there's any truth to the thought that Tom Cotton, senator, might be under consideration for Department of Defense, and whether Marco Rubio might be under consideration for Secretary of State. He would neither confirm or deny, but he projected open-mindedness to those names. They're looking for people who are both competent and loyal to Trump. And, you know, I think they think the first time around they found a lot of competent people who couldn't stand Trump and would betray him at the first turn. And then they found some people who loved Trump but were incompetent. And they're looking to fix both of those problems.
Is it right to call this election the podcast election? Is that what we've just seen?
Well, it's funny because there's a podcast that was formed by the former Obama guys called Pod Save America. That was in response to Donald Trump winning. And I do think, actually, ironically, Pod has saved America. It just happened in 2024. Joe Rogan's pod, Sean Ryan's pod, a lot of these big pods that Trump went on and that not just he went on, but that reported on Trump honestly in a way that counterbalanced the misinformation that was being put out about him at every turn by the mainstream so-called media.
The problem with that, though, and you know this, you ask tough questions, and you have during your career, famously, of Donald Trump, actually, where you had quite a falling out with him very famously on air before he was before he became president. Are you not worried that if we go down the kind of podcast rabbit hole, that the ability of journalists to put really tough questions and follow-up questions to key players is lost?
That's a concern, for sure. There's a risk. I'm not going to deny that. But I think if you build a show that is big enough and strong enough, the risk diminishes. Joe Rogan could have asked Trump whatever he wanted to. But I will say, even on my show, which has been alive for 4 years now, I gave Trump a very challenging interview in September of 23, and he did not like it. And he immediately went out and started ripping on me not too long thereafter. But with time, he got past it. And I'm sure I'll be interviewing him again soon. And he had me speak at his rally. So if you play the long game, there is room for that. I mean, 2 days before the election, I had on the Republican running for Senate in Montana, who was favored to win. And it did not go well for him. Not at all. Now, he just won. Mm. He's the senator-elect from Montana. I'm sure he's not going to be running back to the MK show anytime soon. But it's not about my relationship with any one guest. It's about my trust with my audience. So I think net-net, if you come on and you don't lie, you'll be fine. And I know I'll be fine.
We had Scott Jennings on the program the other morning. And he is the Republican, former political operative, of course, now a CNN commentator. And he had this moment in the middle of the night on election night where he just sort of ripped into all the mainstream media and the way in which the conversation in the networks and among all journalists, really, has just completely taken, in his view, leave of where people are, particularly working class Americans. What do you think happens now to America's, what some will call legacy media, mainstream media? Where do they stand in the Donald Trump, the new Donald Trump era?
Well, look, Trump is a ratings magnet, and in that way, he's revived them yet again. His enemies, because they can't stand him, ironically, he's given them a lifeline. I don't think CNN would have made another 4 years covering Kamala Harris. She would have been incredibly boring. They would have been running cover for her. It would not have been interesting. So they should be grateful Trump won. However, they've all been outed as such dishonest brokers. I mean, they continue outing themselves, but they openly declared war on the guy with the fascism lie that they peddled, such that they can never rebuild with the right half of the country.
Do you think they're finished?
Yeah. Oh, I think they're dead. They're dead. They just might not know it yet. It's a slow death that's, you know, sort of, it's going to happen slowly and then all of a sudden. Let me put it this way. CNN on election night, I think, had 4 million viewers. You know who else had 4 million viewers on election night? I did. Hmm. I guarantee you the cost of my show is a tiny, tiny little fraction compared to what it costs CNN to put all of those shows and all of those people on air all night. It's just not a winning business model.
Megyn Kelly, good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Well, we asked CNN if they wanted to comment, but they declined. CNN got 4.7 million viewers on election night. The Megyn Kelly Show's election night special has had 4.1 million views on YouTube.
Coming up, how can we unlock the use of NHS data to deliver better treatments for us all and do it safely and securely? But at 14 minutes to 8, that comes after Thought for the Day. The speaker in the studio with us this morning is Bishop Richard Harris. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning. 55 years ago, two women gave birth to girls in a West Midlands hospital. Now it's been announced that the NHS are going to pay compensation because they'd been switched at birth. The babies had been taken away at night to give their mothers some rest, as was the custom in those days, but next morning they'd been taken to the wrong mother. Due to some chance DNA testing, this has now been discovered, and of course the effect on the two families has been totally traumatic. For although our genes shape so much of what we do, the relationship we have with our mother, or mother figure, is no less decisive and colours our whole attitude to life. As Freud put it, he who is the favourite of his mother goes through life with a sense of a conqueror. Which of course poses the question, what about those who are not the favourite? Recently I saw Shakespeare's Coriolanus at the National Theatre. What's so interesting about this play is the link between the personal and the political. Coriolanus is a strong Roman general who is urged to stand for election. But behind him is his mother, for she is the dominant figure in his life. His uneasy relationship with the populace reflects his relationship with his mother and depends on whether he will do what she wants or rebel against it. Some of us are blessed to have been brought up by wonderful mothers or mother figures. Some people I know have had a horrible childhood that saved them for life. What the gospel suggests, however, is that whatever formation we had as a child, we can find a new home in a new community of care that transforms everything. There's a rather disturbing story of the time when Jesus was teaching and surrounded by a crowd when someone came in to tell him that his mother was outside, and Jesus replied, "Who is my mother? And who are my brothers?" And pointing to his disciples, he said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother." Sounds a bit hard on his mother. But she remained close to him and was by the cross when he was crucified, as was the beloved disciple John. It was then that the truth of what Jesus said became clear, for she was told, "Here is your son." And John was told, "Here is your mother." And from then on, she made her home with him. Whether our mothering has been wonderful or flawed, it's open to us to create new communities of mutual care.
That was Thought for the Day with Bishop Richard Harris. It's now 11 minutes to 8.
We are in the UK in a rather special, if not unique, position when it comes to medical data, because almost the entire population of around 68 million people use the same National Health Service. But a report out today says there are barriers to how our vast mass of health data is used, and those barriers need to be removed in order to improve patient care and research in fields such as cancer, heart disease and dementia. Well, the chair of the review that's led to the report is Professor Kathy Sudlow. Her own original field was neurology, but she's long worked on population health and in enabling health research through tapping into data sets. Morning, Professor Sudlow.
Morning.
Can you give me an example of something positive that could be happening in the use of NHS data but isn't?
Yes, one of the things I discovered during the course of conducting this review was that although we collect across the country data about people who attend programs for screening, bowel screening and breast screening, for example, to detect their risk of future cancer and get treatments to them if required, we have no systems routinely to link the data from those screening programs to the data on who actually then goes on to develop cancer outcomes or die from cancer in the future. And so we're not in a position routinely to be able to understand about how to improve those screening programs, how to target screening better to improve lives in the future. We're not using our data as well as we should be. That's okay. But one example. And we're letting patients and families down as a result.
But we must have the data within the NHS. For example, someone goes for bowel screening and how long they live afterwards, what their life expectancy is when they die, if the outcome is not good. Do you mean that that knowledge is there in the system, but we can't tap into it?
Yes. Well, I mean, we can tap into it, but we don't do that optimally. So the knowledge, the data sources are held in separate silos. And we do have now safe, secure systems that allow us to link them together, but we're not using those optimally and well. Let me give you another example. During the course of COVID, we really improved the systems across the country to pull together data from different sources, from general practice, from hospitals, from COVID infection screening and from COVID vaccination. So we could really start to understand who's getting infection, what are their risks, which subsets of society are most at risk of both acquiring infection or of not being vaccinated, for example. And not to do that, not to do similar exercises to help us understand the risks and new treatments and new ways of preventing cancer, heart disease, diabetes, okay, seems to me to be very perverse and inappropriate. We really need to be improving things for people and not letting them down in the way that we
are. One of the barriers has been concerns about security of data, and you've said that you think that system is there. What about the point about giving drug companies access to this data in a way that's obviously going to benefit them? And that there's a good in that, in drug development for people's benefit. But there are also big private sector profits to be made, and indeed those drugs will then be sold back into the NHS.
So I think the real issue here is to think about the benefits, and if we think about the purpose of the use of data and the benefits that are derived from it, and put patients and the public at the heart of the decision making and involve them all the way through this, then we'll get the decisions right about how the nation's data could and should be best used for public benefit. The NHS cannot, our health system cannot exist without partnerships with the commercial sector. So all the computer systems that support the NHS come from the commercial sector. We need a life sciences industry to develop new drugs, new devices and new treatments to improve healthcare in the future. But we need to make sure we have patients and the public involved in and at the heart of the decision making about what good uses are, so that we get this right.
Okay. Let me bring in Mark Effingham, who's the Deputy Chief Executive of the UK Biobank, which is now 18 years old. 500,000 people signed up. They had their DNA sequence. Mark Effingham, I think I know that there are that those are data sets that are available for use in different ways. What's the impact in these 18 years that you're most proud of?
So good morning, Michelle. So as you say, we've been collecting data from 500,000 volunteer participants for over 15 years, and it's been vitally important that we're able to receive access to NHS health record data to follow their health outcomes over time. It's the only way that we can see what kind of conditions participants are going to develop, and allow approved researchers to have access to these de-identified versions of these data to enable them to better understand why some people go on to develop a particular disease and others don't. In that time, there's already been over 12,000 published scientific studies that describe many opportunities for new diagnoses, new treatments, from everything from cancer to diabetes, heart disease and depression. And there's not enough time to give you all the examples here, but for example, type 1 diabetes, using biobank data, it was discovered it's not just something you develop as a child. 40% of cases start after the age of 30, and knowing that allows us to put the right patients on the right treatment path lines.
But are you being held back? That's what I'm wondering. Is the world that Cathy Sudlow is describing, is there a barrier to you?
It is. We've been able to bring in record data from hospital records, from death and cancer, but that really is just the tip of the iceberg of what could be done. Any data that we can bring into a resource like UK Biobank just massively amplifies the value of that data in ways that we can't quite imagine. We saw during the pandemic, when barriers were removed, we were able to bring in primary care data, and that's really important because a lot of the conditions that we know scientists want to understand better, such as diabetes and asthma, we can only do that work when we get access to data such as primary care.
From GPs' practices, essentially.
Yes.
Cathy Sudlow, would it, if the barriers are removed in the way that you want and that this report suggests need to happen, would it make the NHS more efficient?
Yes, undoubtedly. So a system that cannot learn from its own data can't improve. We need a constant cycle of the data that the system, that the health and care system generates, being used to help it improve itself. And that's the part that we're not doing as well as we could and should. But I think that, you know, the examples that Mark Effingham raised are a really good one as well. So there are many research studies, and Biobank is a very large and very prominent example of one, that have the consent of their participants to link to their health records to follow them up over time. It's a really efficient, effective and economic way of following the health of research participants in trials like the recovery trial, which many people will remember helped us to understand treatments that were helpful for people with severe COVID and treatments that didn't work. But those very individuals can now be followed over time, provided we enable the linkage of those individuals to their data from these different sources. And we don't yet have the systems well enough in place and streamlined in a way that allows us to do that effectively. And I think that's a failure to patients and the public, and we should be doing better.
Professor Cathy Sudlow, thank you very much. And thanks also to Mark Effingham of the UK Biobank.
At 3 minutes to eight, time to find out what is happening on Any Questions tonight. Here's Alex Forsyth. Morning.
Hello, good morning, Nick. It is, of course, the week in which the US has chosen its next president. And so we are at the American Museum in Bath. And poised to consider all of the possible consequences of Donald Trump's victory, we have Lord Kim Darroch, the former UK ambassador to the United States, Emily Thornberry, the chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, Dame Harriet Baldwin, shadow business minister in Kemi Badenoch's new team, and Reform UK's immigration and justice spokesperson, Anne Widdicombe. Hope you can join us. We will be live as ever at 8 p.m. here on Radio 4.
Thank you very much, Alex. And now Elizabeth Rossini with the weather.
Thank you, Michelle. Well, it's looking very similar to how it was yesterday for most of us. It's another very gloomy, cloudy picture across much of England and Wales, also Northern Ireland as well. But there will be some more sunshine for Scotland. Now, we're starting off the day with temperatures in high single figures, low double figures. So again, it's mild for the time of year. There's some mist around, some drizzle as we've been seeing in recent days too, especially for western coast. And that low cloud is just set to last throughout much of the day. Yet again, it's not quite as breezy as it was yesterday either, and it is starting to feel a little chillier now too. A few breaks in the clouds, so some pockets of sunshine that's most likely across the northwest of Wales and to parts of northwest England too, perhaps spreading up towards southeastern areas of Scotland. But the best of the sunshine again will be across northern Scotland. Not quite as warm here as it was yesterday when we got to 19 degrees Celsius with a bit of added fern effect too. There's a moderate easterly wind blowing towards the south, and we'll see temperatures peak at around 12 to 16 degrees Celsius in Scotland and in Northern Ireland, but just 9 to 12 degrees across England and Wales underneath those layers of cloud again. And tonight it's more of the same. Overnight lows for many of us at around 5 to 8 degrees Celsius. Some more mist, low cloud and drizzle into tomorrow morning. Tomorrow, again, more of the same, but we'll start to see a few changes with the arrival of a weather front in the north and the west on Sunday.
Elizabeth, thank you. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain and Nick Robinson.
It's 8 o'clock on Friday, the 8th of November. The headlines this morning: Donald Trump has begun selecting his new administration. He's chosen Susie Wiles as his chief of staff. She'll be the first woman to serve in that role. The Dutch Prime Minister says he was horrified by attacks on Israeli football fans in Amsterdam. Israel is sending two planes to pick up supporters of Maccabi Tel Aviv. And a secret recording appears to show an Azerbaijani official overseeing this year's UN climate talks, offering investment opportunities in the country's oil and gas fields.
And coming up before nine, we talked to the head of MI6, former head of MI6, about how we deal with Trump and Putin. And we'll hear why the late great folk musician Nick Drake has made such an impact on the actor Mackenzie Crook.
I've written this strange little love letter to Nick Drake in the form of it's a nursery rhyme, really.
And the world's most famous marmalade-eating Peruvian bear is back.
Aunt Lucy always says you can take the bear out of the jungle, but you can't take the jungle out of the bear.
We'll be talking to the writers of the new Paddington film. All that after the BBC News, read this morning by Jane Steele.
President-elect Donald Trump has made his first key White House appointment, naming Susie Wiles, one of his two campaign managers, as his new chief of staff. It's the first time in US history that a woman has taken that role. Traditionally, the chief of staff oversees the daily operations of the White House and advises the president on policy issues. Our North America correspondent Nadia Taufik reports from Florida.
When Donald Trump delivered his victory speech on election night, one of the people he turned to on stage and credited for his win was Susie Wiles. The 67-year-old longtime political strategist, he said, liked to stay in the background. Now he's elevated her to one of the top jobs in the White House, where she will make history as the first woman to hold the title. In a statement, Mr. Trump described her as tough, smart, innovative, and universally admired and respected. In his first term, the former president went through four chiefs of staff who advised him on policy and day-to-day operations. This time around, he's looking to appoint loyalists to carry out his agenda. And one of his first priorities when he takes office, he's told NBC News in an interview, is to make the border strong and powerful. He said people must come in legally, and he had no choice but to carry out the largest mass deportation of illegal immigrants to secure the country, no matter the cost.
In his first interview since Donald Trump won the American presidential election, the Foreign Secretary David Lammy has told the BBC that criticisms he had made of Mr. Trump in the past were old news and that he had felt in his bones that the president-elect would win for some months. Mr. Lammy was speaking to our political editor Chris Mason, who reminded him of some of the comments he had made.
So, April 2019, you said, deluded, dishonest, xenophobic, narcissistic, Donald Trump is no friend of Britain. Have you changed your mind, or is that still your view?
This is old news. Here, Chris, I'm sitting here as Foreign Secretary. I've had a meal with Donald Trump. I've met Donald Trump.
Did you talk about this stuff? Did you apologise? Did he bring it up?
Not even vaguely.
You can hear the full newscast interview with David Lammy on BBC Sounds. President Putin has praised Donald Trump in his first comments since the US election. Speaking in the Black Sea resort of Sochi, Mr. Putin said he had offered his congratulations to the president-elect, adding that he was ready to hold talks with him about the war in Ukraine. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg was watching.
Donald Trump will have absolutely loved what Vladimir Putin said about him. Speaking at a political discussion club in southern Russia, the Kremlin leader praised the way Trump had handled himself during the attempt on his life back in July and called him a courageous man. Then more praise for the US president-elect's stated desire to improve relations with Russia and help end the war in Ukraine. The Kremlin will be hoping to build a productive relationship with the Trump administration, one that does indeed help to end the Ukraine war on terms beneficial to Russia. Mr. Putin added that he was ready for discussions with Donald Trump.
The Dutch Prime Minister says he was horrified by attacks on Israeli football fans in Amsterdam and has spoken to his Israeli counterpart. Benjamin Netanyahu has announced two military aircraft will fly to the city to bring home fans of Maccabi Tel Aviv Football Club. They were in the Netherlands to watch their team play the Dutch side Ajax in the Europa League. Our correspondent Joe Inwood is in Jerusalem.
Videos on social media show people being beaten unconscious. One appears to show a man in a canal being told to say Free Palestine. The scenes were condemned by Israel's Prime Minister, who called them premeditated and anti-Semitic. Benjamin Netanyahu also announced two planes would be sent for what he called a rescue mission. There are also multiple videos showing what appear to be Israeli fans tearing down a Palestinian flag from a street in central Amsterdam, with anti-Palestinian chants audible in the background. The sequence of events is not yet certain. What is clear is that they were about much more than just football rivalry.
A report is calling for better access to vast amounts of NHS data that can be used to improve patient care and help research into conditions such as dementia, cancer and heart disease. The review says the NHS holds medical details for tens of millions of people going back decades, but access to them can take many months or even years. Our health editor Hugh Pym reports.
The independent review led by Professor Cathy Sudlow concluded that the potential benefits from the large amount of health data in the UK were not being maximised. Research about common health conditions, she said, was too often prevented or delayed because systems for accessing the available information were too complex and patients were being let down. Professor Sir Chris Whitty, England's chief medical officer, said that the report should help health leaders and researchers use data more effectively for patients while maintaining confidentiality.
An Azerbaijani official overseeing this year's UN conference on tackling climate change has been filmed offering to arrange meetings to discuss potential oil and gas deals. Elnur Sultanov was recorded secretly by human rights activists ahead of the COP29 meeting, which starts in Baku on Monday. Our climate editor Justin Rowlatt has seen the footage.
We have a lot of gas fields that are to be developed, the COP29 chief executive Elnur Sultanov tells the potential investor in the video. He offers to set up a meeting with the Azerbaijani state oil and gas company SOCAR. The man is actually a representative of the human rights organization Global Witness. Attempting to do business deals as part of the COP process appears to be a serious breach of the standards of conduct expected of a COP official. Neither the Azerbaijani COP29 team or SOCAR responded to our request for comment.
The managing director of Harrods has personally apologised for the first time following the sexual abuse allegations which have been made against the store's former owner, Mohammed Al-Fayed, who died last year. The BBC approached Michael Ward at Harrods headquarters, where he said he was sorry for what had happened. Ellie Price reports.
I am very dreadfully sorry for what has happened with Al-Fayed. The words of Michael Ward speaking in person for the first time about sexual abuse allegations against his old boss, Harrods' former owner, Mohammed Al-Fayed. Hundreds of women have alleged the billionaire raped or sexually abused them. Harrods says it's engaged in a settlement process with more than 290 women, and there are also separate legal claims being brought against the luxury department store. Michael Ward has been managing director of Harrods since 2005 and worked alongside Al-Fayed until 2010, when new owners bought the business. He has previously said he did not know of any abuse and that no formal complaints have been brought to him, although rumours of Al-Fayed's behaviour were in the public domain.
The parent company of British Airways, IAG, says its operating profit in the 3 months to the end of September was £1.7 billion. That's an increase of more than 15% on the same period last year. IAG says it expects the strong financial performance to continue for the rest of the year. The family of a nurse who died after taking weight loss injections is calling for greater awareness of possible side effects of the drug. Susan McGowan from North Lanarkshire is believed to be the first British person whose death has been officially linked to the drug tirzepatide, known as Mounjaro. Our correspondent Katrina McPhee reports.
Susan McGowan was 58 when she died at the hospital where she worked. She'd been taking the weight loss drug Mounjaro for 2 weeks after buying it legally from an online pharmacy. Her death certificate lists multiple organ failure, septic shock, pancreatitis and use of prescribed tirzepatide as her cause of death. Susan's niece Jade wants to warn others of the possible side effects of the drug. Lilly, which makes Mounjaro in the UK, said patient safety was its top priority and Mounjaro was approved based on extensive assessment of its benefits and risks. The regulator, the MHRA, said new medicines were monitored more intensively for safety issues.
The Prince of Wales has described the past year as the hardest year of his life. Speaking to reporters at the end of his visit to South Africa, Prince William talked about how he's coped after his wife and his father were diagnosed with cancer. The heir to the throne said he was proud of both the Princess of Wales and the King. Researchers at the University of Toronto have been studying the way vampire bats use the blood they eat for energy. The scientists said their results showed how metabolism can be shaped by a specialised diet. Ken Welch, who's an associate professor of zoology, led the study. He says the information was gathered by getting the bats to run on a treadmill.
There are these tiny little treadmills that are made for things like rats that you can run them on and you can measure their metabolism by measuring the rate at which they're breathing in oxygen and breathing out CO2. And we gave it a shot. And you can see the videos associated with the article. They are little champion runners galloping along.
Ken Welch speaking there.
So if you head to the gym later today, prepare to see a bat on the treadmill. Frankly, probably can run quite a lot faster than I can. Jane, thank you very much indeed. It is 8:10 now.
Vladimir Putin did his best yesterday not to look as delighted as he surely is that Donald Trump is heading back to the White House. The Russian president did, though, praise the next US president as a courageous man who behaved like a man when he faced an assassination attempt. And he went on to declare, we're ready to talk to him. Putin knows that Trump, unlike his predecessor Joe Biden, has never expressed his determination that Ukraine should win its war with Russia. He has instead simply declared his belief that he could stop people on both sides dying and do it in 24 hours. All reasons that Ukraine's allies are worried. We'll talk to the former head of MI6 in just a moment. First, though, our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg followed President Putin to southern Russia to hear his reaction to the news coming in from the United States.
You know, in Russia, not all big announcements are delivered in the Kremlin. I'm up a mountain above the Black Sea resort city of Sochi, looking out across snowy peaks and forests. It is stunningly beautiful. And it's here that Vladimir Putin has chosen to make his first public comments about Donald Trump winning back the White House.
President of the Russian Federation, Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin.
Applause for the Kremlin leader as he arrives at an event on the mountain, the annual meeting of an international discussion club. And one of the subjects to discuss is America's president-elect. First, Putin calls Trump a brave man for the way he handled himself during last July's assassination attempt. Then more praise for wanting better relations with Russia. Moscow, I think, sees plenty of pluses from a Trump presidency. The Kremlin, I think, is hoping Donald Trump will help end the war in Ukraine in a way that benefits Russia. And political scientist Sergei Karaganov can see another advantage.
Trump will spur the retreat of the United States from the position of a global superpower to a position of a global normal power.
Do you think Russia now has a friend in the White House?
We have an enemy, but a bit more responsible one. But a bit less predictable one, too.
Unpredictability? Well, there is that. One Russian newspaper this week wrote that Donald Trump was like an unguided missile. He can fly off in any direction. Plus, remember last time Trump was in the White House? Russia and America didn't exactly hit it off.
We all remember the first term of Donald Trump, and there were many expectations in Moscow about his ability to put this relationship back on track. However, it did not happen.
Andrei Kartunov is from the Russian International Affairs Council. Here at the discussion club, he tells me what he's hoping for now the US election is over.
I hope that at least some communication lines between Moscow and Washington, D.C. will be restored under Trump. It does not mean that the two sides will come to a common denominator or reach consensus on any serious issues, but to restore communication lines is still something which is very important, and we do not have it right now.
Everything that Trump said on the campaign trail must have struck a chord with the Kremlin. His criticism of the scale of US military assistance to Ukraine, not blaming Vladimir Putin for the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine. Surely, Moscow must be overjoyed that Trump has won.
I think that the victory of Donald Trump fits rather nicely into the overall vision of the world, which is dominant in the Russian leadership today. Trump is a symbol of the defeat of neoliberal political trend in the United States.
The title of this particular session of the discussion club is Together into a New World. It's almost as if they knew what was coming. If you're Ukraine, this new world is frightening. Many Ukrainians fear that a Trump administration won't stand by their country. But to Vladimir Putin, the post-US election world is a place in which he clearly feels more confident and more powerful.
Steve Rosenberg reporting there on the first comments of Vladimir Putin. And listening to that, Sir Alex Younger, former head of MI6, the Secret Intelligence Service, from 2014 to 2020, including Sir Alex over the period of the last Trump presidency. Good morning to you. Are you in any doubt that Putin is as pleased as Steve Rosenberg thinks he is?
No, I think this is classic spy bluster. And, you know, I should know. Putin has access to the best psychologists and would have thought very carefully about how to send the most manipulative and flattering message he can manage. Now, he will undoubtedly be very pleased by this development. But I think also he knows there's a lot in play here. There's a real risk that he overreaches. And there's a reference in the earlier report about Trump's unpredictability. Could remember, Putin is a tactical opportunist. That's kind of what spies are like. But strategically, actually, he sent some very mixed messages about what is going to happen next.
Trump, on the other hand, seems to be clear when it comes to NATO and when it comes to Ukraine. He doesn't much like NATO. He has been clear that he is not willing to do what it takes to win the war in Ukraine. So how should Ukraine's allies now react?
Well, I think there's three things, Nick. First of all, can we please accept the world as it is, not as we would like it to be? We could have a long conversation about, you know, how stuffed we are. But the reality is the previous policy, letting Ukraine lose slowly, wasn't working very well either. So we do need to be open-minded about what comes next and use the real influence we have to get it to work for us. Secondly, Trump. Yeah, I did serve opposite him, and the Trump administrations do what it says on the tin. So he will attempt to engineer a rapid solution. But he's been pulled in two directions. There will be a land swap. That is a terrible thing for the people who end up living under Russian rule. But fundamentally, it's not the main argument. The main argument is whether Ukraine is a Western or Eastern country in the future. And Trump's advisors, on the one hand, are saying that Ukraine should be forced into unilateral neutrality, so basically back into the bosom of Putin. Others are talking about the need to do a land swap, but then reinforce its military and economic capabilities. And we need to make sure we are compounding that second argument. And then thirdly, look, Europe, you heard it. I think this is the biggest point made by Sergei Karaganov and others in your previous clip. Trump is disdainful of alliances. He takes a highly transactional approach to them. In any case, the security guarantee we've enjoyed since the Second World War 80 years ago is obviously going to have to change. So if Europe doesn't smell the coffee now and understand that it needs to work to own its own security, then, frankly, we will not be forgiven by future generations.
Is that simply, in the end, a question of money, of Europe living up to the challenge that Trump sets for them and saying, pay for your own defence?
Well, certainly. I mean, firstly, I think by doing that, we don't make it more likely that America will go. We make it more likely that they will stay. If we demonstrate that we are adults in the space and prepared to defend ourselves, that will help. But in any case, given Trump's well-stated views, we need to have the capacity to stand on our own two feet. Money is important, and I don't make that assertion lightly, given the fiscal problems that we've got. But defence is the first duty of a government. But it is broader. It's culture as well, honestly. I think as Europeans, we need to understand what we have in Putin and the extent to which he will be emboldened by this. Our capacity as strong, rich economic powers to deal with this if we focus, but the consequences of not doing so.
I want to explore what you were saying in your second point. Let him talk, you're saying, Trump to Putin. Let him talk about Ukraine giving up some of its territory. But are you suggesting that there should be a red line when it comes to the idea that Ukraine has to choose to be outside the West, outside Europe, that it has to be neutral and that Putin can get what he always wanted, which is Ukraine not part of the Western alliance?
That is the key point. So if you listen to Putin's speech before he launched his ill-fated invasion, it wasn't actually about the Donbass or even the Crimea. It was about whether Ukraine is a Western or Eastern country. Ultimately, this is not about territory. It's about sovereignty. If we push Ukraine into the position where it has to accept unarmed neutrality alongside loss of territory, that will embolden Putin to a degree that makes Europe's position highly perilous. Yeah. But it also puts Trump on risk, because I think he will own a fiasco if he attempts to go down that route. And I think he will come to see that. If there is a land for peace deal, regrettable, of course, but accompanied by commitments, probably short of NATO, if we're to be realistic, to the residual Ukraine, Europe is in an incomparably stronger position. That's the vital ground of the conversation. Putin will be very, very focused on this in his conversations with Donald Trump. And we need to get our point over really clearly.
A last thought then for you, which is, I hear you in your first answer saying we've got to accept the world as it is.
Yeah.
But can we trust Donald Trump with our intelligence? When you were head of MI6, Trump gave away Russian intelligence to the Russian ambassador, famously on one occasion. He published a photograph he shouldn't have published of a missile on another occasion. The front page of the I newspaper today says Trump could threaten to hold back intelligence from the UK as a way of trying to put pressure on us. Is the old Five Eyes agreement under real strain now?
No, I managed the relationship during this entire period. I did so with an open, frank and transparent relationship with my counterparts in the agencies in the US, along with my counterparts in the UK. That relationship ended that time stronger than it started.
So you believe, despite the fact he has referred to intelligence being part of the deep state, a deep state that he's prepared and determined to demolish, that we can continue having an intelligence relationship?
I think that's a domestic issue for the US, the whole approach that Donald Trump takes to appointments and institutions and his contempt for the separation of powers, etc., are all issues that we need to worry about. But you asked me about the practical experience that I had in my last term, and that is that the apparatus stood up really well.
So, Alex Young, former head of MI6, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
The time is now 22 minutes past.
Now, you might expect Michelle to say something now, but we're going to say something about her instead. And she doesn't know this. Because last night, Michelle, and sadly I couldn't be there, had a rather exciting evening. She won the Charles Wheeler Award for Outstanding Contribution to Broadcast Journalism. And we just wanted to pay our own tribute to Michelle on the programme this morning. Now, in case you haven't been listening for all that time, Michelle joined us in 2013, before I joined the programme. Joined the BBC in 1998, BBC World News in 2001. And the award was for all of that, not just her work here at the Today programme. An award for all her journalism over the years, going back to 2014, when she reported for this programme from a school attacked by the Taliban in Peshawar in Pakistan.
We are the first journalists who've been allowed into the premises of the Army Public School here in Peshawar.
So as we walk down the steps, there's a very large amount of blood here. School books covered in blood, empty bullet cases, someone's glasses lying broken on the floor.
Most of the skilled workers I'm putting to you, you're suggesting would still be allowed. So midwives, is that a yes?
In limited numbers.
Architects?
In limited numbers.
Butchers?
In limited numbers.
Bakers?
This is really getting rather silly.
Well, it's a large... That's what I'm suggesting.
This is complete and utter nonsense.
On the numbers. Just one moment. I just one moment. I want to clarify something. Small boat arrivals did come down last year, but arrivals so far this year are at a record high. It's more than 13,000 people. Have you lost control, as Keir Starmer has said?
No.
You didn't use the word shithole in Parliament?
No, I didn't.
So when you picked up on a microphone, who was talking? So, who said the word in Parliament?
No. You need to do better research, because I've made it very, very clear what I said. I was referring to an individual.
Okay, you used the word shit, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
You used it, Michelle. On air, Michelle used it. Talked to James Cleveland before that, in case you didn't hear the Prime Ministerial debate. Nigel Farage being interviewed and reporting from Pakistan. And I should tell listeners, you didn't know that was coming.
I didn't.
Spent most of the past minute shouting through the glass.
Yes, head in my hands. I'm absolutely mortified. There's a page in the running orders which says stand by two. I thought it was some kind of rogue page. I had no idea.
It was a rogue.
What was going on?
The editor and I had plotted it.
I feel like I need to retire now after you've done that.
No, absolutely do not do any such thing.
It's very, well, it's very kind of you to do that. And I've been really lucky to work with great colleagues for many, many years. So there's always a team behind every moment you hear on air, good and bad.
Many more to come, we hope. And just to stress, look, there are lots of awards. There aren't lots of Charles Wheeler awards. This is the award for outstanding contribution to broadcast journalism. And I have a hunch that in... over breakfast tables, in cars, in showers, who knows where, there are millions of people just now saying, hear, hear to that. Well done.
Enough. Your judgment is normally very good. Let us move on, because it is nearly 50 years since the death of singer-songwriter Nick Drake, and in that time his following has grown. He is ever more of an inspiration to new generations of musicians. And now the actor Mackenzie Crook, creator of Detectorists, has written and illustrated a book about him. It's called If Nick Drake Came to My House, and he's been talking to us about it.
Betty came by on the way, said she had a word to say.
The music of Nick Drake was recommended to me for a long time before I finally got around to listening to it. And instantly I was bewitched. And I think I was trying to learn to play the guitar at the time and decided, yeah, this is stuff that I could play probably. And I soon discovered that there's absolutely no way that I could play this music. It's so, so intricate. I've written this strange little love letter to Nick Drake in the form of it's a nursery rhyme, really. It's masquerading as a children's picture book, but it's not for children. It's called If Nick Drake Came to My House, and it's inspired by a Sunday school book that my dad received for Christmas in 1941, called If Jesus Came to My House by Joan Gale Thomas. And I was always transfixed by this book and the idea of meeting a ghost and getting to tell them what you want to tell them about how much you love their work.
Now I'm darker than the deepest sea.
The album Pink Moon was the first one that I listened to that was actually his last album. It's so stripped back, it's just him and his guitar, and Place to Be is the one that really made my ears prick up. It's a sad song, and the last lyric, now I'm weaker than the palest blue, oh so weak in this need for you, finishes off the song, and that lyric struck me. It just devastated me. It's such a sad line, but that's what I like in my music. Yes.
Now I'm weaker than the palest blue, oh so weak in this need for you.
He died 50 years ago this month, at the age of 26, before he knew success. It's not necessarily my voice in the book, and in fact, I've drawn my son in the book. That's who answers the door. So it's not Mackenzie Crook. When my son Jude was born, one of my jobs was the early morning feed at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I used to get him up and I would feed him whilst playing Nick Drake to him, hoping that through some sort of osmosis it would sink in and he would learn an appreciation of his music and music in general. And it's properly worked, because my son is a brilliant musician and he can play Nick Drake songs. He understands the alchemy of music and how it's made. Somehow both my children are great musicians.
I never felt magic crazy as this. I never saw moons, knew the meaning of the sea. I never held emotion in the palm of my hand. I felt sweet breezes in the top of a tree, but now you're here.
I think I've come to realise over the years that's what I do, is tell stories, which, yeah, sounds a bit twee, but whether it's through acting or through writing, and then, yeah, now perhaps through illustration as well, I guess I'm a storyteller. I don't know if this is the beginning of something. Somebody asked me if I was going to do a series of these, opening up the door to different ghosts from the past. But I don't think that's what it is. This is very much a tribute to Nick Drake, and I'll leave it there. But I do love writing. I do love illustrating. And so hopefully other projects will occur, and I'll do more of that in the future.
Mackenzie Crook there, paying tribute to the singer-songwriter Nick Drake. It is 8:30, and it is time for the sport. Here's Mike.
Thank you, Nick. Big night awaits in Dublin. Ireland against New Zealand kicks off the second weekend of Rugby Union's Autumn Nations series, and you can listen to that match from 8:10 this evening on 5 Live and BBC Sounds. Meanwhile, in football, wins in Europe last night for Manchester United and Chelsea. Defeat, though, for Tottenham. You can see all the results from the Europa League and Conference League on the BBC Sport website. In women's football, the draw was made yesterday for the 2025 Nations League, with England placed in the same group as the team that beat them in the World Cup final last year, Spain. Well, one player who will be hopeful of featuring in that tournament is the Arsenal and England defender Lotte Ruben Mooi, who I met earlier this week. The 25-year-old is a one-club woman, having risen through the Arsenal Academy, and has now taken on an additional ambassadorial role with the club. Indeed, she's launched her own initiative called Lots to Explore, which encourages disadvantaged young girls to explore the creative industries through football.
Every year we have two groups of 15, 16-year-old girls, 20 of them, that are part of an eight-week programme that come down here. They do a mix of football, but more importantly, creative studies courses with us here. And that's a nod to who I am today. I definitely wouldn't be the player or person that I am today without the creative juices that I have flowing within my family. But I think that sort of facet of life is something that we don't visit enough in the schools today, but also in general life, off the pitch and out of schools.
You are making yourself, by virtue of just being here today, very accessible to the fans. Could the modern day footballer be more accessible to supporters? Are some players too removed from those who essentially pay their wages?
I definitely say that it's a unique part of women's football, that we are not so far removed from the fans, and we can share part of our lives, part of our passions with them. And I think that's what allows us to be such a unique style of football. It's the same game that we play as the men, it's just sort of on a different playing field that we embrace, and I think we embody as women.
Now, as well as your performances on the pitch, you are known for your activism off it as well, as you've touched on. It was you who came up with the idea of, along with the other England players, writing an open letter to the UK government after the Lionesses won the Euros in 2022, calling on schools to deliver a minimum of 2 hours of PE a week, something which they duly did. 2 years on, have things improved for young girls and their access to physical education?
Things have definitely improved. I think it's almost in the 80% of schools that actually offered minimum of 2 hours of PE a week, which is what we were demanding in that letter. Sport should be accessible to everyone. We know the benefits that it can have in terms of soft skills, self-esteem, self-expression.
Sent into that six-yard box, and Italy struggling to clear. A lot of Mooi, a special moment for her, and look at the celebration. Scores her first goal for England.
And what about the profile of the women's game globally? There was some anger in some quarters last week when the Ballon d'Or was once again organised for a week when all elite women players and coaches were on an international break. What does that say about how the organisers view women's football?
Of course, there should have been an understanding that the women need to be at that Ballon d'Or ceremony, and the fact that they were unable to be because of international break isn't good enough. And that's sort of one example of where I think there needs to be growth and more understanding and push to have decisions made that aren't just with men in mind. And I'll use the word bravery. I think there needs to be a lot more of that in those leadership positions. And I know as players we're pushing by, fundamentally not staying silent in that sense, but pushing to have our voices heard when we do not agree with something.
And as for Arsenal, mixed start to the season, I think it's fair to say. Fifth currently in the WSL after six games, 7 points off the leaders, Manchester City. And of course, to some people's surprise, your manager, Jonas Eidevall, left the club last month. Were you surprised to see Jonas leave in the way that he did?
I think as players, we reflected on that time as a means to look in the mirror and take accountability for ourselves. Obviously, the situation with the manager is something that we can't control, and the decision was made in a point in the season when we hadn't been performing as players. There were consequences, and those consequences are lost points, which ultimately is putting us in a difficult situation with the rest of the league coming up.
And Jonas has been replaced by his long-term assistant, René Sliger, someone who you know quite well, having worked under her for several years.
She's a wonderful, wonderful coach. I worked obviously more on an individual basis with her. She mainly took a lot of the individual sessions for players as an assistant coach. So now being able to take that understanding of the players on the individual level to a more team level now.
Would you like to see her get the job full time?
That's an interesting one. She's been fabulous so far, and I think whatever decision is made will be made with the club's ambitions at hand, and that is for us to push to win the league and compete in the Champions League.
Whether it's Renee or not, do you and the other players in the first team have any preference on the next head coach being female? Less than half of the managers in the Women's Super League are women. Is it a personal preference, or perhaps not an issue for you at all, that the next manager of Arsenal is a woman?
I think we don't not only have a shortage of female coaches in WSL, I think we don't have enough female coaches in England as a whole, and a reflection, I think, since the Euros has been that there aren't enough female coaches coming through the ranks, and the FA are doing a lot to offer through the PFA to provide us with opportunities to get involved in coaching, and that starts from the lower levels. A few of my teammates are currently doing the UEFA, I think, B licence, and that's an exciting prospect as a whole to potentially put more female coaches in those positions in England but also in the WSL.
Lotta Vuvenmoy, thank you so much for speaking to us on the programme.
Thank you, Mike.
Great chat to Lotta Vuvenmoy there. You also heard commentary of her first England goal from ITV Sport. And Arsenal women play Brighton in the Women's Super League this evening, and you can follow that on the BBC Sport website.
Mike, thank you.
I'm Claudia Hammond, and I'd love to know, is there a person or a group who has made a real difference to your mental health? You can nominate them now for the All in the Mind Awards. For Josephine, winning in 2023 made her feel stronger.
The awards have given me a kind of extra superpower. It's a special recognition of a difficult task.
To enter and for full terms, visit bbc.co.uk/radio4/allinthemind. You have until 1 p.m. on Wednesday, the 8th of January, 2025 to enter. Can't wait to read what you have to say.
Now, Claudia, a quick look at the weather. Mostly dry and cloudy today, but bright skies in northern Scotland.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson, Michelle Hussein and Jane Steele reading the news.
Donald Trump has made his first appointment of his future administration. His campaign manager, Susie Wiles, will be his White House chief of staff and the first woman to hold the post. Earlier, in an interview for NBC News, the president-elect reiterated his promise to carry out a mass deportation of illegal immigrants. The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, says the government will try to persuade Mr. Trump that it is not in his interest to harm the UK by increasing tariffs on British exports to the United States. The president-elect has said he wants to increase tariffs on imported goods by 10%, rising to 60% on items from China. The Dutch Prime Minister, Dick Schreuf, has condemned last night's attacks on Israeli football fans in Amsterdam and promised that the perpetrators would be tracked down and prosecuted. The violence occurred after a Europa League game between Maccabi Tel Aviv and Ajax. Israel is sending two military aircraft to bring fans home. An independent review is calling for better access to vast amounts of NHS data that can be used to improve patient care and help research into conditions such as dementia, cancer and heart disease. Professor Kathy Sudlow, who chaired the review, told us that data was being held in different silos. She said linking them together could be done safely.
Jane, thank you. It is coming up to 20 to 9. When a Gaza ceasefire and hostage release deal appeared possible in the summer, it was thought that Marwan Barghouti might also be freed from an Israeli prison. The Palestinian leader, who is not from Hamas but the Fatah group which leads the Palestinian Authority, has been in jail for more than 20 years, convicted of 5 counts of murder. He's been seen as a charismatic figure, someone with enough authority to be a potential leader for all Palestinians, though his limited access even to his lawyers means that not much is known about what he thinks today, and if he could be, as his supporters believe, a Palestinian Mandela. I've been speaking to his son, Arab Barghouti, asking first what his father would be saying and doing if he was out of prison now.
I think the first thing that my father would be doing is to unify Fatah first, because Fatah has a real problem within the internal division within Fatah party, which is his party that he's been a part of for more than 50 years now. And then he would work for a whole Palestinian unity. And I think that we Palestinians need unity the most now to be stronger in facing the Israeli assault and occupation.
Would he reconcile with Hamas?
Yeah, I think that he would be, you know, interested in having Hamas under the PLO. I think that having all Palestinian factions, not only Hamas, under the PLO is a positive thing to the stability of the whole region, not only in Palestine, because that way we will be making decisions together, and you won't have any political factions just, you know, declaring war or doing any step without consulting with the others.
But does that reconciliation mean that he would be comfortable with what Hamas did on October the 7th?
I mean, my father is on the record before he was in prison and inside prison in his famous interview with Lindsay Hilson in 2006, where he went on the record and said that he's against the targeting of civilians, regardless of who they are, Palestinians or Israelis.
But he himself is in prison on 5 counts of murder, the deaths of 4 Israelis and a Greek monk. And he was the chief of Fatah's armed wing, the Tanzim, and Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, which carried out many attacks targeting civilians inside Israel, called him their leader as well.
The conviction came from an Israeli court, the same court that has been putting Palestinians in prison without trial in administrative detention, which is illegal by international law. He also denied those allegations because he's a politician. He didn't deny his role in leading, being one of the leaders of the Second Intifada and the uprising and calling for the people to protest against the Israeli occupation. But of course, he denies any role in military actions.
I can see that you see the court process as flawed. But it does seem to have looked at all the allegations on an individual basis. For example, it found there was insufficient evidence to connect him to 21 other deaths that were in the original indictment.
I mean, if you listen, I can give you all the sources from independent international lawyers who did review his case. And the conclusion that they came up with is very simple. It's impossible to say that Marwan Barghouti has been given a fair trial. They have no proof that he had anything to do with any military action. He's a politician and he's somewhat a parliament member, and he was doing his role of leading the Palestinian people.
When did you last see him?
2 years ago.
In what circumstances? When you go to prison, what was it like then?
It was normal. He was in Hadarim prison, the prison that he stayed in for 18 or 19 years, because the first 3 years of his imprisonment, he was in solitary confinement. And before I turned 16, I used to see him twice a month. After turning 16, I would see him once every 2 or 3 years, which is, of course, illegal by international law. My mother was banned for 4 years, and she just saw him 2 years ago after the ban, and now she hasn't seen him in 2 years as well. So this is pretty normal for us to go through this. And, of course, thousands of Palestinian political prisoners go through the same.
In Gaza, Arab, they say that they're targeting Hamas, and it is a war that began after October the 7th. When you saw those scenes, you must have thought that Israel's response was going to go beyond anything that had happened before.
I mean, no one can convince me that they would, you know, imagine killing 18,000 children and 10,000 women and those many civilians under the excuse that Hamas started that war. Hamas did not start that war. I think that if you look at the numbers in 2023, hundreds of Palestinians, most of them were civilians before October 7th, were killed by the Israeli occupation. And it was the highest number since the Second Intifada in more than 20 years. So I think that this narrative is unacceptable for me. I would never accept the killing and the slaughter of that many civilians under the excuse that we're targeting Hamas. They're not targeting Hamas. They're targeting the civilians. They know exactly what they're doing. And they have one
but
of the most...
You would acknowledge that Hamas also killed civilians and took civilians, including young children and elderly people, hostage.
Of course.
Is that acceptable?
Of course not. we would never condone, I would be a hypocrite to come here and to condone, you know, targeting civilians, kidnapping civilians. But what I'm saying is there is no excuse for the response that Israel is doing.
Your father, if he was free now, how would he offer Israelis the confidence that they would be secure in a Palestinian state he leads?
To be honest with you, I really don't appreciate that narrative that we Palestinians that are oppressed, that are being killed every day, it's our job to provide Israelis with security. I think that the Israelis want to have security until they understand that without ending the occupation, they will never, ever have security. And these are the words that I repeat from my father's court in 2004, and he said it clearly.
But I'm asking you to imagine that those two states exist. So how could Israelis in their state be confident that there would be no cross-border attacks from a Palestinian state?
If they just try to give us our rights and to give us our independent state and to get out of our Palestinian territories and to give us what we deserve, which is independence and statehood and living with dignity. And dignity is the key word here because we don't live with dignity. We're occupied, we're oppressed. If that all ends, I promise you that Palestinians will get to a point where we accept the existence of Israel as a neighboring country.
Why do you say you don't live with dignity when you live in Ramallah, the city that is the seat of the Palestinian Authority?
A few days ago, in my city, in Ramallah, Israeli settlers, they came to the city, they burned 20 cars, they burned the building with full civilians. The same in the northern of the West Bank. The northern of the West Bank is going through another genocide because there has been airstrikes on Jenin, on Tul Karim for the first time since 2004.
Which Israel says is targeting militant groups. And you would acknowledge, wouldn't you, that there are militant or extremist groups that anti-Israel ones, which are active in those areas?
Yes, they are resistance groups because they exist in the Palestinian territories. Under the international law, we have the right to resist our occupier. And if they keep, you know, attacking every single one who's trying to resist the Israeli occupation, there won't be left any Palestinians. What options do we have? What choice do we have?
If there was a ceasefire and that his freedom was part of that, what kind of resistance would he advocate?
He would advocate for uniting the Palestinian people, and he understands very well that the solution for this is political solutions and not military solutions. I always say Hamas is not a building that they can blow up. It's an ideology, and you can't defeat an ideology by killing as many people as you can. He's someone who believes in political solutions, and he would provide the opportunity for political solutions. He would come to the table for negotiations with the Israelis and with everybody else to bring everyone together. So uniting the Palestinian people, building a Palestinian state, and negotiating for political solutions for the whole conflict is what he will provide.
Arab Barghouti, son of Marwan Barghouti. Thank you. Well, the Israeli Prison Service, IPS, told us since October the 7th, Barghouti has petitioned twice regarding claims of mistreatment in prison. The court has examined every one of his claims and concluded that there has been no violation of the law by IPS. And in relation to Gaza, the IDF denies targeting civilians.
At 12 minutes to nine, let's turn to an extraordinary story. Israel's Prime Minister, Isaac Herzog, is talking of a pogrom. Maccabi fans of the football club Maccabi Tel Aviv, attacked on the streets of Amsterdam after a Europa League match between Ajax Amsterdam and Maccabi. The Dutch Prime Minister has condemned what he calls completely unacceptable anti-Semitic attacks on Israelis, and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has announced that two military aircraft will fly to the city in what he's called a rescue mission to bring the fans home. Well, let us talk to our correspondent now about what we know. Joe Inwood is on the line. Can you tell us what we know? Some dramatic, some appalling on the face of it video evidence of what happened. What do we know factually about what did and didn't happen?
So the videos on social media, which of course come with the usual health warning, but they really clearly seem to show fans of the Israeli club being attacked in the Netherlands. There's one video of a man being beaten unconscious and another one which appears to show a man in a canal being told to say Free Palestine or being forced to say Free Palestine. And these are videos that have been condemned by both the Israeli government and the Dutch government as showing anti-Semitic attacks. There are also videos, and I've seen the same event filmed from three different locations, so we can be pretty clear what it shows, which appears to be Israeli fans tearing down a Palestinian flag and shouting very offensive chants against the Palestinian people. So there were clearly incidents on both sides, but it is a night of violence that's being taken very seriously, as I say, by both governments.
So provocative acts, perhaps, by the Maccabi fans, but it is the violence, extreme violence by the sound of it, that has led people to talk of it being like a pogrom.
Yeah, absolutely. That was the phrase used by Isaac Herzog. He's the president of Israel. And it's a very, very strong phrase. Just to give people the context, pogroms, it comes from a Russian term, but it really relates to anti-Semitic massacres and expulsions that took place in Europe in the 19th and 20th century. Now, for context, those often involved hundreds, thousands of people being killed. So it will be seen as a very, very strong phrase to use, but that is the phrase that the president here has used. The Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said these attacks were premeditated and anti-Semitic, and that's the phrase that's also been used by the Dutch Prime Minister.
Joanne Wood in Jerusalem, thank you for joining us.
It's 10 to 9. The next international climate talks, COP29, begin in Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan, on Monday. Ahead of them, the BBC's had access to a recording that appears to show the Azerbaijani official in charge of the talks offering opportunities to invest in the country's oil and gas sector. The Azerbaijani COP29 team has not responded to the BBC on this. Here's our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt.
COP29 is definitely the most important event of this year.
It is the world's biggest climate conference.
This is the time when everyone needs to come together.
But it seems the chief executive of the COP29 team has other things on his mind.
We have a lot of pipeline infrastructure. We have a lot of gas fields that are to be developed.
Mr. Soltanov thinks he's talking to a potential sponsor. In fact, the man is from the human rights organisation Global Witness and is posing as the head of a Hong Kong company which wants to make fossil fuel investments. Mr. Soltanov, who is also the Deputy Energy Minister of Azerbaijan, does talk about tackling climate change.
So the purpose is solving climate crisis. So as long as anybody, including oil gas companies, could come with solutions, our doors are open.
But he wasn't just open to climate solutions, he was open to discussions about oil and gas deals too. Mr. Soltanov is also on the board of SOCAR, the Azeri State Oil and Gas Company.
There are a lot of joint ventures that could be established, potential joint ventures. Our SOCAR trading is trading oil and gas all over the world, including in Asia.
He is eager to get discussions going.
This is something that you need to be talking to SOCAR, and I would be happy to create a contact between yourself and them, your team and their team, so that they can start discussions.
A couple of weeks later, the Hong Kong investment company received an email. One of SOCAR's most senior executives wants to meet in Baku and says Mr. Soltanov said to get in touch. Now, attempting to do business deals as part of the COP process appears to be a serious breach of the standards of conduct expected of a COP official.
C'est un petit marteau, mais je pense qu'il peut faire de grandes choses.
The Costa Rican diplomat Cristiana Figueres was in charge of the UN climate process during the landmark COP conference in Paris in 2015.
It's completely unacceptable. The expectation that anyone would go to the COP to cut new deals on fossil fuels is not only contrary and egregious to what a conference of the parties on climate change is, it is frankly a betrayal of that very process.
These UN climate conferences are supposed to be about reducing the world's use of oil and gas, not selling more of the stuff. The UN's code of conduct says officials should remain impartial and avoid any conflicts of interest. Neither the Azeri COP29 team or SOCAR offered any response to our request for comment. The UN did not comment directly, but stressed its requirement for impartiality from all officials.
Hearing no objection, it is so decided.
Last year, the BBC obtained leaked documents which revealed plans by the UAE to use its role as host of COP28 to strike oil and gas deals. Yet, for the first time, the world agreed at that conference the need to transition away from fossil fuels. It shows progress could still be made at COP29.
Justin Rowlatt reporting, and you can go to the BBC News website for Justin's full report and also more of what to expect, from COP29.
It is now 5 to 9.
Coming up straight after the news, it's Desert Island Disc, but first, Paddington. You just say the word, don't you? Makes you feel good. Makes you feel warm. And it will even more if you get the chance to see the new movie, Paddington, in Peru. And delighted to say, in the studio, we're joined by the writers of what I see has been referred to in some places as a threequel, the third Paddington film. James Lamont and John Foster are here. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Is it daunting? Paddington is so much a part of people's lives, people who love the books. Is it daunting to be handed that bear to take care of?
Absolutely. There is a certain weight of responsibility that we all feel. And I think that, I like to think that Paddington arrived at Paddington Station with a little note around his neck that says, please look after this bear. And I think that anybody that works on this project, whether it's, producer Rosie Dougal, the director, us, anyone that works on it feels that that note has been written for them. Please look after this bear. And that's what we've sort of done our best.
John, do you find yourself in the writer's room going, no, Paddington wouldn't possibly say that?
Well, yes. When we wrote the script with Mark Burton, I feel like a lot of the time we would ask ourselves, what would Paddington do in this situation? And it is pretty much a sort of guiding light for everybody involved in the film. And it was definitely a guiding light for us as writers. And do you know what a beautiful thing to be able to ask yourself that in a writer's room?
Yeah.
It feels like Paddington was there the whole time with us. And that was very special.
What's the original inspiration for Michael Bond, the Kinder Transport, and seeing children arrive with labels around their necks?
Yeah, it's certainly true. I mentioned the label. Michael Bond has said that when he grew up in his hometown, he saw a lot of the evacuees during the Second World War arriving at train platforms and the Kinder Transport as well. With these
Reading, I think it was.
Yeah, I believe so, yeah, with the labels around their neck. And he said that was a great inspiration for him, both about how London and Britain could accept strangers into their land and take care of them, and what the kind of values that says about us.
And that is the interesting thing, isn't it, John, which is the films are about the relationship with home. That's what makes them poignant as well as fun.
Oh, for sure. And I think everybody who's seen the first movie would remember that Paddington comes to London and he is looking for a home. And we think this third movie is the sort of continuation of that idea, that Paddington goes back to his homeland, Peru, and it's an exploration about how he will feel when he goes back to the place that he came from. And actually, you know, when Paddington comes to London, he becomes part of a family, the Brown family, and we see this film as very much about the evolution of family, about family growing up, the change that happens.
Yeah, it's true that the Brown family themselves have changed in this movie. They've grown up. They're going off to university and experiencing new things, and I think there's probably certainly people at home that they're kids might have just gone to university, or they might have like newborn babies and they don't want their kids to ever grow up. And this movie sort of explores the sort of themes of like what happens to family as it changes, and who we are and where we belong and what we call family.
Speaking of changes, are there ever any changes at the voiceover part? Like, do the actors ever deviate from what you've written?
Well, I mean, that is true. Yes, that would happen. Obviously, when you've got such great actors as Olivia Colman and Antonio Banderas coming into this third movie, as writers, you present them with the best possible script you can. And of course, when brilliant talent comes along, they are able to kind of elevate it into something bigger, something more real, something more fun.
She plays a gun tooter. No, a guitar playing nun, doesn't she?
She does indeed.
But he's a riverboat captain.
Yes, yeah. Antonio plays a sort of swarthy riverboat captain. And Olivia is sort of a little hints of Julie Andrews.
Is it a problem, though, taking him away from home? Because so much of what we love is like the hot chocolate with Mr. Gruber, isn't it? And it is the domesticity, not just of his home, but of the whole street.
Well, I feel like Paddington is the Paddington we know and love in any situation, and he's bringing the Brown family with him to Peru. So that feeling of London is there throughout the film, that feeling of what we've had in the first films.
Yeah, the movie starts in London, but it definitely, it's the same system because he's been away from Peru for so long that he's now kind of a fish out of water there.
Mm. Well, the film...